Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
All right, we are heading right into the end of the year here.
Yep.
And as we've been discussing things before the podcast, just to warn y'all, maybe a bit of a weird episode. We're in a weird place.
We're setting ourselves up, and
or maybe
it's not
going to be really
weird.
Dull. And
yeah, it's going to be very dull. It's going to be our blandest.
I don't think that's going to happen.
We're all on lack of sleep. We're all in the middle of a crazy holiday time.
It's always funny when we start texting each other at 8 a.m. and everyone responds.
Everybody being awake at 8 a.m. is not okay.
Yeah, this is like the staff group chat sort of thing.
Wait a minute, what?
But if I might. The text, the very important text that Dave sent to our manager chat that we all need to know at 8 a.m. Dave, would you like to reveal the key part of
that? Sure, sure. I was working at home on some store business.
Yes, yes.
And I wanted to let y'all know that I had updated it so that my Christmas playlist now had Christmas ska music.
Yes, which resulted in a flood of gifts.
Yeah. Usually I'm up at that hour and other people aren't, so... Yeah.
Serena's the early morning person.
Do you know that I thought this was one of those days in my head. I had fallen asleep earlier, it had discombobulated me, and I was like thinking that I came in at noon, and so when I couldn't sleep well, I was like... It's fine. I've got till I can get up at 11. It's fine. And then that was not the case.
Nope.
It was not the case. And so, yeah, we're running on low sleep. It might be weird.
Yeah. But it might be normal. We might fall asleep, all of us, midway through because our mouth is warm, and then this podcast is going to be white noise for the last 25 minutes.
We'll just call this episode, They're All Tuckered Out.
And we'll post it. I'm not going to edit it. I'll just leave the white noise.
Yeah, and there's also the distinct possibility that Dave will just start blaring ska music.
Trumpet section.
It'll come out of his ska port.
His ska port.
Anyway, so game stuff to report this week. We got in a few new games. We got in a game called Penny Dreadfuls. Nothing to do with the show. I saw somebody comment on Facebook. They thought it was like, "Oh, Penny Dreadful show was great." I wonder what the game is. Nothing like that. It is a game about.
What is this game about?
I don't know. Penny Dreadfuls.
I don't know if people know, but Penny Dreadfuls is like a name for like an old like English. Like they're cheap, they're pulp books.
The
trashiest true crime novels of like the late 1800s were called Penny Dreadfuls.
Yeah,
so what the movie was trying to, or the television show was trying to,
right? But like the show did not invent it. I'm dropping some knowledge here. I'd like to educate little bit.
The full name of this game is Penny Dreadfuls of Victorian London. There is no board game geek rating. It's too new.
Oh, okay.
But it is a, you will, 1 to 5 players share a bizarre and frightening tales, masterfully narrated by our authors, set in gloomy Victorian London in the late 19th century, influenced by the mysterious serial murders in the neighborhoods of Whitechapel and Whitehall.
Wait, okay. It's like a storytelling game?
So that's what, each game is a variable number of turns, depending on how player interprets, yes, it sounds like maybe a storytelling
that
game.
That actually interests me.
Yeah.
Do you remember, years ago, I don't know if people know the character of Baron Munchausen, Terry Gilliam mm-hmm. made a movie.
Robin Williams, but Baron Munchausen. Yep.
He was the man in the moon, but he was supposed to be this like in the Napoleonic era. A kind of a tall tale telling adventurer.
Yes.
Who in the movie I think has adventures, but like also, or maybe it's like I guess they're meant to be tall tales. And at one point they did a little indie game based on him, where you would spin tales. And it was a drinking game, and people could call you out and be like, well, that's bullshit or whatever. And then you kind of have to elaborate on your story. It was like, well, okay, I didn't meet the man in the moon, but what did happen was...
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this sounds like this could be kind of a creepy Jack the Ripper-y version of like a storytelling game.
Yeah.
I will look more into the game Penny Dreadful.
We got a game called The Glade, which is one of the games I played at BGG. It's a very cute game. There are four different, there's little tokens that represent like badgers and hedgehogs and all sorts of stuff and frogs and that kind of thing. And what you do is you make sets on your board and you're trying to build these sets and other people can build off your board as well.
Hmm.
It's a very complex game.
Right, I was going to say, it's like, it sounds like, are you paying attention to multiple people's boards?
Because you want to make a set, but you may not have a set on your board, but you may be like, oh, I can complete this person's set.
Okay, that's a unique sounding mechanic.
That'll give
like
them
that.
Points, but it'll also give me points. And
So what you're saying is, just because it has woodland creatures in it does not mean it is a casual
game. No, this is definitely not a casual game. I guess, you know that game set, that card game set?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It has a set mechanic like this, where the sets are like, everything is the same except for one thing. So it's like you can do all frogs, all green, but one different type of terrain or something like that. It took a minute to understand, but it was a really interesting mechanic.
Okay.
So if you want something slightly different, but also with a cutesy theme, maybe it would be worth looking at.
You know, I feel like there's been, I think, a little burst of those kind of games. What's the woodland game that was so big? Root.
Yeah.
But that's like battling woodland
beasts.
It is.
Yeah.
It's the era of the woodland creature. Parks. All right, what else we got?
Battling beasts. We got the Walking Dead RPG.
Oh, yeah.
Which I believe there's a starter set as well as a player.
One of those box starter sets, just like, you know, like D&D does it. A lot of major game releases will do it. So, like, somewhere between $20 and $40, you get, like, a starter box, gets you through a first adventure, teaches you the rules while you're playing. So that's pretty cool. And then, the actual core role-playing game book is also out.
Is there an adventure?
There's a GM screen.
GM screen. Okay, I think there were three things.
Yep.
So, you know, it's funny. I think none of us are, like, huge Walking Dead fans, right? Either TV show or comic. But as a role-playing setting...
Sure.
And there's been plenty of zombie apocalypse games, but I don't know if anybody's done any, like, this is the apocalypse, the zombies are there, you're not trying to figure out what caused them, you're not trying to, you know, end the zombie plague, you're just, like, trying to survive in this world. I don't know if any people have done that game.
There was a smaller press zombie game, like, 10 to 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Do you remember this? It had, a reddish cover, hardcover. Oh, my gosh. It was like kind of a rules light system, you know, in that Savage Worlds type vein.
Okay.
I'm going to look it up in a minute. It's like, All Flesh Must Be Eaten.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Quite the name, right?
Yes, yeah.
I knew it was something weird, and eventually my brain got
to it. Yeah, there you go.
I forgot
about that game.
But it did kind of just disappear, weirdly, while a lot of other zombie properties were flourishing. Maybe they just, you know, hit some financial trouble. I don't know.
This makes sense to me as a role-playing game, though. I'm like, I can see lots of
I saw some interesting tables in there that were, like, tables that helped you, you know, random tables that helped you kind of create different little communities and dangers and threats that were coming up with them. So, you know, if you ever backseat driving, coaching an episode of Walking Dead, like, I would have done this. Well, put your money where your mouth is, buddy.
Right.
Pick up a shotgun, face the governor.
Wow, okay.
Do it now.
You're talking about all the tables. I thought you were going to win Nick over. You have random tables.
The only way you can win me over is if there are aliens involved in this one.
Right. Nick hates zombies. He's a big wham-wham baby man.
You have to really sell me on wanting to play a full-on RPG of zombies. No. That sounds...
Zombies funnier when
Nick, you would play... Would you play, if I ever do one of those end-of-the-world games where it's like a Norse mythology end-of-the-world and there's Draugr that walk the earth along with frost giants and other stuff?
Yes, because Draugr are not zombies.
Dave, could I play a lazy ice floe jumper in that game?
Man, there's a joke that only you and I will get.
Yep, it's just for you and me. But also, Nick, do you like Anna and the Apocalypse?
Nick was lukewarm.
I was lukewarm on it.
Because of the zombies.
I know. There are exceptions to my all hatred of zombies movies.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's also... I will say this. That's a kind of a cult movie. I wouldn't expect everyone to like it.
I would expect everyone to like it.
Now, it's weird that Nick doesn't like it.
Now, the caveat of that is I watched it when I was sick. And I don't know if my attention was completely on it. I own the movie.
Yep.
So I will...
That doesn't count.
I own Goodfellas. I don't... You know,
I own movies I haven't seen because of you. I own the Batman versus Superman... And I think I might own Justice League. Because you were giving me official codes for a while.
Nick, I recall you mentioning that, one day you're going to return to this movie and see how it is. I would submit that this would be a good month to possibly do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, you must do what you feel is right. I don't want to hurry you into a zombie commitment before you're ready for it.
Nick, what is your exception?
Dawn of the Dead is an exception.
Really?
Okay. And also, the more recent one that I can think of was that #Alive that was on Netflix. It was the Korean one.
Yeah.
It was good. I actually found that to be really interesting.
Did you see Train to Busan?
I did, and I was kind of mediocre.
Oh, that. You know what Nick liked was Zack Snyder's zombie movie.
I mean, Army of the Dead,
yeah.
It was entertaining.
Uh-huh.
Because it wasn't really about zombies, and the zombies
maybe Train
were...
to Busan could learn something from Zack Snyder, King of Zombies.
And to bring this full circle, the aliens in Army of the Dead were the zombies were made by aliens.
Really? They actually
they are.
They finally got to that?
What?
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this. How big a component of the movie is that? Because I've never heard of
it. It's a minor thing. Like, it's just like a background thing that's where the original zombie came. Like,
the zombies are from aliens in Army of the Dead?
Uh-huh.
You know, they've been teasing as far back as the original Night of the Living Dead, basically the first modern zombie movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's the comet.
That there was like, yeah, that there was a meteorite or something like that.
Yeah. It's a silly thing. I don't know.
Nick
you
was
know.
Just like, the instant he heard aliens, he's like, 4 stars.
Not really zombies.
No, no.
Asterisk.
Army of the Dead was probably like a 2.5 star.
Okay, great.
The other RPG we got is a Superhero 5e RPG.
Yes.
Which, it's got the main rule book, and then like a, what looks like maybe a roster book, like a character book.
And then there's an adventure,
and an
I
adventure.
Believe.
I didn't get to look too much through this. You guys look through it, see the art or anything?
No, it's unfortunately shrink-wrapped.
Oh, okay.
You know what? Yesterday I took a book out of shrink-wrap that was that 100 springboards thing.
We have one of those unshrink-wrapped. Someone must have bought the unshrink-wrapped
copy. Yep. And like almost no sooner had I done it, and I was like, oh, this is pretty good looking. I decided to buy it for myself, and then somebody else came in, and they also decided to buy one.
Did we talk about that at some point, the 100 plot threads
I don't
thing?
Remember if we did.
This is for
new.
Just like a one-shot, right? Or like
it's 100 one-shots that you can drop into any adventure. And like, I should say, they're like little, not a whole campaign or anything, but it's like a one-page, and sometimes even smaller, springboards.
Yeah.
And the thing that I thought was cool about it was, first of all, some of them are kind of lighthearted and fun. There was one that I was like, this would actually be a great first adventure for kids if you weren't trying to like be all like killy-kill
yeah.
with the adventure. There's like this giant toad that's perched on the little roof over the town well, mm-hmm. and he won't go away. And there's like local merchants that are debating him. One of them is like, that guy's it's messing with business. I want him dead. And he hires a mercenary. Then there's another guy who hires you, the players, and he's like, please protect the giant toad. It hasn't done anything wrong. And you end up on a toad escort mission to get him back to the swamps. And he's apparently kind of like, he's, what would be the word? He doesn't want to go. He's recalcitrant. I don't know.
throwing down thesaurus words.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
He's a recidivist.
Also, your escort mission, that's a warning bell for me.
No, we all know that we're suck ass at it. But no, their thing sounded fun. They're like, there's actually some kind of, it's like a flock of crows will come after him. You have to figure out how to deal with them. I feel like a DM can make this fun where it's not like the drudge work of a video game. And there's some secrets and things to learn in there, too. But every one of the adventures has three tag words to it.
Yeah.
So it's like mysterious, island, and, undead or something like that. And so you'll have a sense of what the vibe of this thing will be. And you can drop them in anywhere.
And it's also organized by, like, locale. You can like, there's your island adventures. Here are, you know...
That sounds really cool.
There's a thing at the end where they have suggestions for linking some of them for campaigns or by location. So there's a little sort of bonus material in the back. What's it called, though?
Oh, man, it's like 100 one-shots or something like that. It's...
Yeah.
These are the same people. They did a Spiral Bound thing that was like character ideas that we had. It's a Kickstarter that we did.
Okay, yeah.
And their stuff has been really
good.
But
this is a nice, like, hardcover.
It's a nice hardcover, though, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Flip through it when you're in. Now, we sidetracked to that. We were talking about...
Superhero 5e, which you don't know much about. It's just a 5e edition of superhero RPGs.
Yeah.
Is it one of those that... a lot of times they send us stuff shrink-wrapped, especially sometimes Kickstarter things and stuff like that. And, like, if there's not, like, a map in them... Like, we'll sometimes open them up because we want people to see the interiors. A lot of times they have great art.
Yep.
And for some reason, they don't want you to see them.
Yeah. I think it's protecting the shipping kind of thing.
Yeah. If we can, we might get one of these open so you can give it a flip.
But anyway, it looks cool. A superhero 5e game is a cool idea.
Yeah.
And we've already got... Somebody did something like Sentinels of the Multiverse or something. Yeah.
And a lot of stuff
based.
Has been, you know, they like did versions of Legend of the Five Rings, Lord of the Rings,
right. Yeah,
all the things that have rings in them.
Doctor Who just got one.
Yep.
Doctor Who and the Rings.
Yep.
The Sonic RPG.
Yep, finally.
Why is there
not
a Sonic RPG?
You'd think there would be one. Yeah. It'd be a good starter one.
Sonic and the Golden Rings.
Why isn't there Super Mario Brothers?
I don't know.
It's not a popular thing. Oh my gosh, we were talking about something and I forgot
Super
what I was going to say.
Superhero 5e, Sonic RPG.
Yes, I don't know. I guess now I can know what the challenge rating of a Dalek is.
Yes. We got a game called Dios Mio, which is a party game.
Okay.
Yep.
Uniquely, it is in Spanish and English.
Okay.
I have not looked into it much. I don't know much what it's about, but it's another party game from Asmodee. Those guys do a lot of good party games. And then we got a game. I may have talked about this last week, but just in case. I mentioned it as one of the games I really liked at BGG, but we got the game Kutna Hora, which is a game about a Czech mining town, like a silver mining town, that has a really interesting mechanic where there's a supply and demand mechanic where the resources fluctuate in value throughout the game. And we have the game, and we also have one set of the metal coins,
yes,
which you can use. You know, you can buy with the game, or you can use with any other game. It's always nice to have nice metal coins.
Metal coins are cool.
And the last thing I want to mention, we got a Kickstarter in for Fox Experiment. This is the Kickstarter edition of the game, which means it has nice plastic tokens and upgraded components. And it is the new game from the designer, Elizabeth Hargrave, I believe is her name, the designer of Wingspan.
Mm-hmm.
And I have played this. I played this back at Gen Con a couple years ago. They had the early version. And I believe it to be better than Wingspan.
Ooh, bold words.
It's a really good game. You are
talking trash because you like playing foxes better than you like playing a bird.
I mean, that is true. Birds aren't even real. Though, foxes are real.
This is the one. I can't remember if you... I know we've talked about this off mic.
Yep.
I can't remember if we talked about it last week or maybe when you went to BGG, but this is the one that's, like, inspired by the actual event where they tried to, what, domesticate foxes?
Russia was trying to domesticate foxes.
Like, genetically.
And basically, yeah, you're trying to get the best genetic match of, like, of foxes.
That's how you create a race of super foxes.
I know. And then, yeah, you're all scientists, and each turn you're, like, drafting fox cards that have different attributes, and then you're trying to make the new foxes that have those other attributes. And it's...
Premise-wise, that's weird, but I know this to be a standard thing for a lot of European-style board games.
Yep.
But you said the game mechanics are a lot of fun?
It's a blast. I really, really liked it.
There should be a card that you pull, and it's like, you've created the super fox, and you've doomed the entire race.
You've won. You've outfoxed everyone.
The super fox will kill us all.
That was like sounds fox. Like one of those 80s Skinamax movies, the super foxes.
But at any rate, we also have the Kickstarter exclusive 5-6 player expansion. So it's a 4-player game, but if you get the expansion, it goes into 5-6 players, and that's not going to retail like till next year. So, anyway, I really like that game. I believe that everyone should play it. And if you don't like it, you're a dum-dum head.
Yeah,
you're not a super fox.
Play it and fox up.
Yeah, fox it. All right, let's talk about comics for the week of December 13th. Let's start off with DC's Twas the Night Before Christmas, which is another one of their 80-page giants. It's got...
It's their holiday special, essentially.
What, 8 stories in it?
Yep.
And there is a Batman story in here, I noticed, by Shelley Fish.
Oh, I missed that one.
Yeah, it's the last story.
Oh, okay.
Also, Superman, Booster Gold, Harley Quinn, and Amethyst, which is an interesting... In a story called The Princess Switch, written by Rob Levin, who, going back quite a ways, like 20, 30 years, he worked on the copybook tales with Jay Torres.
Oh, wow.
There is a Lex Luthor tale, the Lextacular Christmas Carol,
yep,
which you can probably imagine what that story is.
Merry Lexmas.
There's a Teen Titans story, a Batwoman story. Batwoman story is called Riddler on the Roof. I didn't get to read these, but the names are fantastic.
Riddler on the Roof is good stuff.
Character called Bunker. I don't remember. Exactly.
Oh, that was from one of the incarnations of the Teen Titans. Yes. Yeah.
Well, his story is called It's a Bunkerful Life. So. I don't know about the stories, but the titles are gold.
Yeah.
Then we got the, from the DC Vault, Batman Robin Lives, which is a one of these facsimile reprints, sort of Batman number 428, which was part 3 of Death in the Family, the one where Robin either lived or died, called because of a 1-900 number.
Yeah, this was back in 1988. For a few days, you know, you got the thing on New Comic Day. It said, hey, readers, we're trying this thing out. Robin's going to live or die. You call us up and choose. And people, like, within, like, I feel like it wasn't, like, a high number of people who voted. It was, like, you know, like 20,000 or something like that. And it was, like, roughly, like, 10K for, 10K against, a little more for against.
I think it was, like, 60 votes or something.
Something like that. And now we have Red Hood. So, good job, murderers.
Yeah.
But, So in our universe, Robin died. But this is a print of the other story, which is where Robin lives. Which I read through, and Damon, I think you may be right. There's actually only one. There's actually only like one big change. One,
I think there's a little bit of re-dialoguing.
Yeah.
So don't expect like, oh, this is the whole untold tale of him. What they would have done
to Jason Todd.
This is just almost like the announcement. Like basically, Batman finds him and Holt picks up the body in his arms. And all that, but like it is a cool thing to have as just like this historical artifact. I guess this is what would have been the what it looks like on some alternate Earth where Jason Todd lived. And
I was gonna say, this is a relic from another world.
Did he become like a in this other world where he lived? Would he become a popular Robin after this? Would he become Red Hood ish?
Yeah.
Would he run away? Like I think he might leave Batman if he's like, well, if you're not gonna kill the Joker after he nearly killed me. Yeah. Then I'm going to have to go become the Red Hood.
There's a... the last letter... This is reprint the letter column. The last letter says, Dear Denny... The editor,
Denny O'Neill.
I heard some of what you're planning for a Death in the Family storyline, including the phone-in number wrinkle, and I didn't want to take any chance whatsoever. Kill him. Your pal, Rich Kreiner.
Wow.
Like, that's pretty great. And there's a little bit from Dan Rassler. This must be the... Who's the assistant editor. Oh, okay. So there's like... They have the original editorial that was going to go in this page, too.
Oh, wow.
So Denny O'Neill basically talking about the whole thing. He's talking about Jim Aparo. This is the thing. But down there below, Dan Rassler says, well, friends, there it is. Despite everything the Joker could throw him in and defiance of the thousands of fans who voted against him, Jason's fight continues. I'm like, so there's the other big change, I guess.
Yeah, honestly, the that sort of background stuff and the way they were even presenting it and all that is interesting, too. So, if you have a fascination with that, if you want to see Batman holding a Robin who's not a corpse, this is your book.
It's an interesting curiosity. I kind of would like them to do a what-if of, like, what might have happened with that.
It's the kind of thing that, you know, a traditional Marvel-style what-if would be good at.
Yeah.
And I think it would have been interesting if he had, say, left Batman, gone, sort of found, put that internal anger to something similar to Red Hood, but maybe not that exactly.
Right.
And had a thing where it's like, what if he had, like, you know, say, pulled together the other Edgelord heroes, so you get Huntress... and like Arsenal and stuff like that, and he basically kind of forms almost this Punisher-esque team that's, you know, instead of... We're used to single loose cannons like Punisher at Marvel or Huntress and them, but what if they had like a team? I think it could be done.
That would be
They
would be the Outsiders.
They were murderers. They were...
No, but like, you know, people are always taking names that don't belong to them, and these guys are edgelords, and they don't care about that
sort
of thing.
Someone else already
took the Outsiders. What do they care about? Copyright?
It's true.
They care about Metamorpho?
Gang War continues over at Marvel with a Daredevil miniseries featuring Elektra.
Yep.
And a second issue of Luke Cage. There's a new Spider-Gwen book.
There's a Miles issue, too.
Oh,
right?
There's a Miles issue, too.
Yep.
Yep.
There's Spider-Gwen Smash, which is a new Spider-Gwen series that focuses on her and the Mary Janes, their band, and them going on tour with another band that is headed up by Dazzler, and features a few familiar faces from the Marvel Universe.
Kind of fun people you will, if you know a little bit of Marvel history, you're like, oh yeah, these people could be in a band.
And she's supposed to be, like, not being Spider-Gwen during this whole thing, and...
I'm going to guess fates conspire against her.
I don't think that's going to happen, yeah. Anyway, yeah, looks fun.
Yeah, if you've got like, a yen for some Spider-Gwen...
A yen for some Spider-Gwen.
A yen for some Gwen. you know what? The opening thing in the last Spider-Verse movie of her band was like one of the coolest things.
Yeah.
I'm glad they're doing something with it.
Space Usagi is getting a reprint in color for the first time. If you don't know, Space Usagi is a thing that takes place in a future where...
It's Usagi Yojimbo, samurai comic.
It's not like he's been transported. Like, it is... It's like a different Usagi, right? Like,
I believe, yes, that's correct. And it's like his
version.
Sort of Star Wars-y kind of comics. It's always a fun thing. I think that it kind of came about because Stan Sakai just wanted a bit of a change-up.
Yep.
And he was like, you know, I wouldn't mind drawing some sci-fi stuff. And Star Wars, of course, so famously inspired by Kurosawa and a lot of samurai stuff anyway. So it sort of felt like a natural.
But they are still, like, they're still space, they're space samurai. They're dressed in samurai clothes.
Do they have glow swords, or do they have sword swords?
Regular swords, but it seems like their swords Some of them have like a one of them has like a vibro sword, and there are blasters and stuff, and there are spaceships.
Yep.
There's a space castle that looks like a space station. Yeah, pretty cool. And if you've never read it, which is possible, it's been out of print for at least like a decade. Yep. Worth a look. We got a new book from Image called The Bloody Dozen, A Tale of the Shrouded College. Nick, you read this one.
I did, and you told me something interesting about it, which I did not realize. But this is kind of a set in the universe of, what was it, Hell to Pay?
Yeah, the Hell to Pay was the first story.
And then this,
the overarching thing is called The Shrouded College.
So it's going to be like an interconnected stories, but you can read them as is, as I did not finish Hell to Pay. But this one was a really cool idea about a... basically, family members getting taxed to do a prison break on a space station.
Okay.
There's magic. There's cool action.
Magic.
This is written by Charles Sewell. Wonderful art by Rafael Albuquerque, who did American Vampire.
Yep. You know, I was just recently reading lesser-known DC work of his. He wrote the tail end or the back half of the Red Lantern series when all the Lantern stuff was popular. And I was quite enjoying it.
He's a really good writer, and he's got a nice sense of adventure here.
Yeah.
And the artist is really good.
Yeah. Who puts that one out?
This is Image.
Image, okay.
And importantly, you don't have to have read Hell to Pay.
No, not at all.
It won't make a difference. Nick didn't even know it existed, really.
Nope. These are new characters, all new characters, new story.
The only thing is it all takes place in a shared universe that where there is a shrouded college that basically will give people magical powers in exchange for doing missions.
Yep. It's a fun premise.
Yeah. We've got a new book from Bendis and Maleev that is called Masterpiece. It's their new book at Dark Horse, and it is about the daughter of these like master thieves who gets dragged into a heist by the billionaire that they ripped off.
Right. She, if memory serves, and she's like high school. Right.
Yeah. Or college, maybe.
Yeah, maybe college.
High school.
Yeah, because that's right, because the teacher is like, introduce yourself.
Oh, right. Okay.
They don't do that in college.
They don't do that.
No. They don't even do it in high school.
Yeah, you know, whatever. but she doesn't know her parents were these, right? She doesn't know that they're these infamous thieves or whatever. Like Randy, you said, like kind of like Ocean's 11 level sort of heisters.
Yeah, like the best.
But yeah, if you're, and it is Bendis and Maleev who did Daredevil and several other projects together, Scarlet and all that stuff. So if you have a fondness.
We've all been highly anticipating this number two. There's a few second issues that came in this week. But Beneath the Trees Where Nobody Sees, number two, comes in this week. This is...
The anthropomorphic comic about the...
Serial killer.
Serial killing lady bear. Who looks like a sweet bear. Like it's like Winnie the... Like Lady Winnie the Pooh, the serial killer.
It's like she stepped out of Berenstain Bears.
Yeah, absolutely.
Richard Scarry's, whatever his thing is called.
Yeah, his thing.
And I will say the second issue lives up to the first one.
Yeah, there's some disturbing ass stuff.
Yeah, yes. This one focuses on kind of a well, I can't think of any other animal. It's a Miss Piggy.
Yes,
Miss Piggy is a big old Karen.
It's like if they wrote Miss Piggy the way she'd really be. Yeah. You know, not like kind of adorably obnoxious, but like really pretty terrible.
Yes.
And there's some scenes in here where the dialogue is really pretty good about how awful she is.
Yep.
But this is a weird kind of like slice of life.
You're seeing the
emphasis on slice.
A number of people and the townsfolk here as. You know, as a reminder, the premise of this is that she is a small-town serial killer, but she goes to the big city to hunt. But someone else has done a very public, they wanted the body to be found and seen by everybody.
In the small town.
Yeah, very gory kill. And she's like, well, I need to find out who this killer is, because not only is this messy, dangerous work, but also it might lead people to some of my kills.
Yeah.
And so she, this methodical lady, and again, you know, think like, I feel like if she was a live action thing, she would have been played in like the 90s by like Kathy Bates or something like that.
Yeah.
So she's trying to hunt the person down. As a result, she's like talking to a lot of people in town, secretly kind of gathering information while the sheriff is asking her like, "Oh, where were you when that was happening? Oh yeah, you know, oh, tell the postman I said hi," and all this stuff.
But it is also the town going in full panic mode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's right. They're selling locks and all this stuff. It's weirdly realistic.
Yeah.
But the
Everyone's an animal person.
Everyone's an animal person.
The art is gorgeous.
The art's beautiful. It's so detailed. There's so much stuff going on.
And this guy's also writing and drawing it, right?
I think so.
I believe that's right.
Patrick Horvath.
Yeah, it is. He is crazy how good he is.
Super talented.
And also, we did sell a number one. There is a second printing in this week, so if you want to check this out, you can check it out.
What's the quote from Patton Oswalt on it?
Oh, something, man, it was like, so good. He's
it's
like,
something like, finally, a...
Forensic murder can be adorable or something.
Yes.
God.
Another anticipated for us, at least, number two. It's a weekly series. Batman Santa Claus Silent Night. I think we all dug this to one degree or another.
Yep. And you know what? Last week, when we were talking about it, I mentioned how the DC solicit had said, it's Santa Claus in continuity for DC. And I was like, well, this is probably out of continuity, but I think that's just a little bit of marketing. I'm pretty sure based on events in this, it is in continuity.
Yep.
And here's the thing. Their Santa is like, because he's like kind of pulled from like, there's like a Scandinavian origins that's, you know, not unlike Claus that Morrison did.
Right.
But a little bit of Thor in there and stuff like that. I'm like, this does actually make the... Is the kind of, you know, Kris Kringle, Claus, whatever he goes by, that could actually work as an occasional DC recurring thing. It's not one of those things where he's going to show up and just give toys. And in fact, there's a very interesting bit of backstory in this about him and Krampus. Mm-hmm. The Krampus. Back in the day, all the major events are happening right now. There's scary stuff happening in Gotham, and some other DC heroes show up in this issue, which is really, really cool. But as story wise, I was most interested by the reveals about. I think I can maybe sort of say this: a sort of partnership at a time, but with Santa Claus and Krampus and. Back in the day, hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, Parker's weaving a pretty fun story. Yeah.
It's much more like thought out than I would have thought it.
I'm really enjoying it.
And the art's great. The art reminds me of Dan Mora on Grant Morrison's awesome Claws.
We got Titans Beast World number 2, which sees some villains and heroes being turned into beast men.
It's like the full on beast plague has hit Earth, and everyone up to and including one of the most dangerous heroes of them all, Batman, seems to be getting hit with the effects. And so
the Titans have to deal with it, and Amanda Waller is skeptical about this. So
yeah, and she's got this alternate plan, and I don't know if she quite gets around to saying what it is, but I know she's like, Mr. President, you got to give me the keys on this one. She's like, you know, there's no chance otherwise. And I'm like, it's probably not good. I don't know what she's asking for, but I'm going to guess it's pretty big.
I think she's going to build an alternate Justice League. I think he even saw like something about that they're, she's basically going to build a government-owned Justice League.
She's like the villain. She caused all this.
Yeah. Outsiders number 2, which is DC's sort of new in-continuity Planetary.
Yep.
Comes out this week.
Yeah, if you were following Planetary, this could be up your alley.
And the much anticipated, for us at least, Batman City of Madness, the oversized black label book by Christian Ward. That is
Batman Cthulhu,
but it has they do a reveal in this that it's almost like there's another, it's almost like an alternate world story,
right?
But the way they do it is very cool. This is a very pretty book. It does interesting take on some of Batman's villains like Two-Face, Ventriloquist. I feel like there's another one, Clayface.
Is it? Is it running slightly late?
It is running slightly late. That happens with the writer artist types. You know.
Gotcha.
Punisher number 2 for those joining the new Punisher. Sees Punisher going up against, I think, 4 Z-list villains, maybe?
It was a fun infiltration issue.
Yeah.
Am I correct that, just at a glance, I haven't read through this yet, but I like the first issue pretty decently. It didn't look like those Z-list villains were treated as complete jokes, though.
No, they're dangerous.
No.
Because I like that sort of stuff. Randy, you and I know, like, one of a formative comic for me, and I think for you, was the Hawkeye miniseries from Marvel.
Yeah.
That had the death throes in it.
Death throes.
They were evil jugglers.
Yep.
But as depicted in this, that and that dude who had the sound, he nullified sound. I forget what he was called. But
Crossfire.
No, Crossfire's the head of it all. The red dude with the little... He has a Crossfire eyepiece. He had, like, brown... He almost looked the way Dominic Fortune does.
He's called Silencer, I think.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
I think it's something else, though.
I think he's called Silencer.
He might be. Nick, if you want to look up, I believe it was Hawkeye number 2.
Yeah.
Is he one of the Death Throes?
No, he is not. That's what's throwing me. I'm like, what are you talking about? And I realized, oh, he's talking about a different villain.
He juggles on a boldness.
I'm going to do a side note within a side note here.
Okay.
So when I listened to Mike Schur's book recently, something I talked about.
Right, Creator of the Good Place, yep.
He has an audio sound cue when he would do a footnote. It would be like, bing, and then it would do another bing when he came back to the main topic.
Yeah.
When I needed, so there needed to be a bing there where I was doing the topic of the side note.
Yeah.
And there needs to be another tone, because the reason I was talking about that side note is so I can tell you about this side note.
Okay.
So there should be a little bing here. Bing, side note. I rewatched Hawkeye.
Yep.
And one of the cops gives him a bag with trick arrows in it, and it's a bag that her wife made for her. And the bag says Bombshell on it.
Oh.
Which I'm like, that's cool, because Bombshell is one of the Death Throes.
That's right.
And I'm like, I don't think so. They're not going to introduce evil jugglers in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Right, it was just a little nod.
But I thought that was a fun little nod.
But my broader point was that I like when Z-list characters are treated with some seriousness. You know, obviously there's some characters that are like almost created as a joke,
mm-hmm.
but the Death Throes actually weren't. You know, the same way Batroc the Leaper, although sometimes treated as a joke, is sometimes a hard-ass mercenary, or where I like him in between, a dangerous enough guy, but you know, not an A-list threat.
I'm sorry, who?
What did I say?
Batroc the Leaper, you mean?
Yes, I didn't realize.
it is Silencer.
Ha ha! Vindicated. All
right.
You thought he would be wrong about a Hawkeye book?
Right. I read it same as he did.
just saying,
and Randy's wrong about a ton of stuff,
but not Hawkeye.
Name one thing.
Can't be Silencer. A lot of stuff. Anyway, so Punisher using these Z-listers is actually a draw to me rather than any sort of negative.
And not to name all of them, because I don't remember all of them, but like Eel is one of them, the electric.
I was going to say Eel is.
And Bushwhacker, who is a Punisher villain. Yep. Actually, he might have been a Daredevil villain originally.
Was Eel he wasn't like an Iron Man villain, was he?
He's either Iron Man or Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Or Daredevil, I guess. He could be a Daredevil villain. I don't know, those people can remember. He could be a Thor villain for all I know.
I will look into this while we proceed.
All right.
It's important that we find out where did the eel
appear.
I think he was Iron Man villain.
Moon Knight number 30 is called The Terminal Seconds of Moon Knight, and spoilers, Moon Knight dies. Not a big spoiler, because they've already announced the relaunch, and they've been talking about this.
How real a death are we talking about? Are we talking about Mark Spector will never appear again?
They go out of their way to say that Khonshu can't help him. And
but he's so tied to mysticism.
The villain is like, basically, one of the villains is like going to kill him, and one of the other villains is mad because he was like, your whole scheme here was like, you're going to kill Mark Spector, but he'd come right back. And then he's like, well, he's not. You're actually going to lose. You don't get to kill your foe, which is an interesting little take. But it seems to be, if not permanent, going to happen for a while. And the way they leave this on the last issue, what they're going to do with Vengeance of Moon Knight number 1, which is coming out in a week. They're not pretending Moon Knight, the character, is going away. They're just doing a new take on it.
Yeah.
It's a good final issue for it. Like, if you've been reading McKay's stories, he has an editorial about how, it's kind of funny. He's like, let me tell you, I got this book by mistake. He's like, Tom Brevoort emailed me about the Moon Knight book and said, I know you're somebody who had expressed interest in Moon Knight in the past. I want to give you an opportunity to throw your hat in the ring on this. And he's like, my hat broke the sound barrier because Moon Knight's one of Marvel's coolest characters. I couldn't wait. However, I don't remember ever expressing an interest to Tom. And he does say, he's like, let's be real. I don't even know my own books are coming out. Tom can tell you the year and number of any single issue of Avengers in the last 30 years. So if one of us forgot something, it was probably me. It was definitely me. But I thought it was kind of funny.
So is McKay going to be writing The Vengeance of Moon Knight?
Okay. He is continuing on.
Okay, cool.
So yeah. Dave, Bing, the Eel.
Man, it's complicated.
Okay, all right.
It was like, first appeared in Marvel Tales, but he was fighting, like, the original Human Torch. This is one of those, it's too complicated to get into.
So he is neither a Spider-Man, Iron Man,
he doesn't seem
Thor
to have
villain.
A very definitive
he was he's a Human Torch
thing.
Villain.
What's the Human Torch's name? Is it Hammond?
Jim Hammond.
Sure, I think.
The Immortal Thor number 5, I think this wraps up the first story arc, right?
Does it seem like I'm used to things running 6 issues, so I'm wondering if there will be some denouement at the end of for the next issue.
But they're doing some cool setup stuff for the next arc, so.
It's a pretty cool showdown with what do they call him?
Tornos.
With some neat surprises in it. And you know, like
The way they defeated him, I thought, was interesting.
Yeah, it is. And also, spoiler warning, that he doesn't destroy and take over the Marvel Universe.
Sorry.
But the thing I was going to say is, honestly, the sort of wrap-up and the kind of the way his various allies interact with him and how he thinks about Storm, Beta Ray Bill,
yeah.
Loki, all those people,
yeah.
it kind of like, there's sort of follow-through stuff with all of them. I don't know, like, for instance, what happened, but something happened with Beta Ray Bill. They
yeah, it's,
had
I believe
a big
that was,
falling out.
I believe that was in the Daniel Ward Johnson
Oh, is
Beta
it?
Ray
That's
Bill
where?
Miniseries.
I thought it was Donny Cates.
Or it might have been Donny Cates' run.
Because I want to be mad Cates. At somebody remember, about breaking them up.
Well, remember, yeah, Donny Cates had him like beat up the Beta Ray Bill.
Oh, that's right.
They had a throwdown.
The fuck is this about? they are brothers. Why did he break up a relationship
they
I like
in their very first appearance?
And Beta Ray Bill
and like one issue later, they're the best besties. Of their blood brothers.
Yeah.
And it's been that way for 100,000 years.
Well, heroes never fight each other, of course.
No, I can work with it. I think that the way... Al Ewing has this way of doing something with that stuff where...
Yeah.
His handling of it is always good, where Beta Ray Bill and Thor are like, man, it's... You know, we had a rough patch, and I know it's not healed over yet, but, like, maybe we're at the start of healing it over.
Right,
and I was
right.
like, okay, that's a good way to handle it. I don't even know exactly what it was. Send us an email, let us know. Al Ewing is like it shows how you can take something and still make it work even without giving all the details.
Yeah, yeah. And then the third issue of Wesley Dodd's Sandman, which I'm really enjoying this book. It does harken back to the Sandman Mystery Theater stuff. Just
yeah, even
cursing
more than we guessed at the beginning.
Yep, there's a notable sporting character who shows up in this
mm-hmm.
one. Any other single issues y'all have to mention?
Like
Green Lantern this week.
Green yep, Lantern.
I actually
was
haven't
fun.
I haven't read it yet, but because it's on my list to read since. But this is an interesting book in the sense that the first issue honestly put me off. I wasn't into it. I might have read one more, still wasn't feeling it. But then I randomly read issue 5, and I was like, oh, you know what? They've actually shown some character art growth for Hal in that span,
yeah.
and they're doing some interesting stuff. There's honestly, issue 5 has a badass action sequence. You know the
yeah.
scene I was talking about, Nick.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I'll check out 6 when I get a chance. Let's see, you mentioned Immortal Thor. Second issue of Raphael Grampa's.
Oh, yeah.
Batman, the Gargoyle of Gotham.
And a reprint of number 1.
And a reprint of number 1. And I think that's it for me.
Yep.
All right. There's also the release of Where the Body Was, which is a new original graphic novel from Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips.
Yes.
Which, this is another, you know, they've done Pulp, Reckless Criminal, all kinds of stuff together. This is their, it's set in the 80s, it looks like. It is a standalone crime graphic novel. I have not had a chance to read it yet. I am super excited. This is always one of the highlights of my year when these guys do a graphic novel.
Does it have any ties to anything that they've done?
I don't believe so. I don't think this is actually... It might wind up being in the criminal universe, but I think it is actually its own standalone thing.
Okay. Yeah, same. You know, Brubaker is such a consummate craftsman.
Yep.
That he basically always delivers. I have to kind of wait till I'm in the mood, and I feel like it might be January.
So
we'll see.
Here's the quick pitch. A boarding house full of junkies... A neglected housewife, a young girl who thinks she's a superhero, a cop who just wants some peace and quiet, and a private detective looking for a runaway girl. These stories collide one fateful summer where a tale of love and murder in the suburbs told from a dozen different points of view.
Yeah.
And then I guess
sounds really cool.
Says it is a map of the crime scene, murder mystery falls, ripples of this crime through decades of love and loss and passion. Sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
Like a true crime podcast crossed with a long-lost diary. Anyway, love these guys getting more ambitious. They
yeah.
definitely can. There's also, we don't always talk about every graphic novel that came this week, but it's worth noting it is a Tom Taylor Tuesday hardcover day,
uh-huh.
because Nightwing Volume 4 and Dark Knights of Steel Volume 2 are both out this week.
Which is this
concluding volume
of Dark Knights of Steel.
Which so. I really like that series. It is their alternate dark fantasy DC universe.
Yep.
I'm not going to actually even be able to remember the name, but I can remember the gist of it. There's a manga that I flipped through yesterday, and it seemed very sweet. Where
I married my best friend.
Yes,
my best
something like
friend.
Yes. I was trying to find it. I think that's it. That I don't even know the circumstances of it, but it follows two women who get married for seemingly reasons other than love, platonic friendship, or maybe there's some. I don't know what else is in it for them.
Okay.
Maybe it's an insurance. I don't know. But I looked through
card?
It, and no, I don't think so. It looked sweet though, you know, one of those quirky stories that manga manga's sometimes very good at.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk about some news and some topics. All right. We got some news to talk about. One trailer to cover. Let's start with Spider-Man Noir, which is animated series? No.
No, it's
live a action series on Prime.
I believe that's true.
Yes. It has a showrunner. His name is Steve Lightfoot.
He
ran Punisher for
Netflix.
Yes,
he ran Punisher for Netflix, which I know people...
That's a good sign, right? Good fit. Good fit.
Yeah. You know, I've expressed a couple times, my skepticism of Sony's non-Spider-Man shows. But a Spider-Man Noir, actually, I'm kind of in. I think this might be...
Every once in a while you're going to get it right.
Yeah.
It's possible.
Could this be a chance? Could they get it right?
Or well, this the thing that this has that none of those other movies that they've been doing does, as Spider-Man.
Spider-Man.
It does have a Spider-Man.
It's also a TV show and not formatted to be one of these Sinister Six type movies.
Right.
That was very clearly an initial game plan of theirs. So it looks different than, say... Morbius and all the rest
right,
of those.
Right, yeah.
I just want them to do like full on noir, do like the narration, black and white.
That'd be awesome.
I don't know if we'll get that. I think it'll probably be possible.
You don't necessarily have to have black and white for noir, but like some of the tropes, you know, the it's basically hard-boiled detectives. Usually there is some sort of narrative monologue thing.
I've never
read a good Spider-Man noir story.
Same. He's one of these characters that I have a hard time writing.
Nicolas Cage did a great job with him in the animated movie. So
yeah.
Right. I feel like it could work. What is the announcement? Like, didn't we already know about this?
We knew it was coming. We didn't know the showrunner, which was notable.
That's a pretty notable thing.
Seems like a pretty good fit.
In the early announcement thing, this is from Collider, which I don't know how reliable they are, but this is apparently they did a screening for Echo, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the bits of news that came out of it was that they are working on a Black Panther animated series.
Right.
At Disney Plus, which is going to be basically the history of the Black Panther. So,
right.
Like, not Chadwick Boseman, but, like, the previous Black Panthers and that kind of
but
thing.
But I'm up for... Marvel Animation's solid, yeah, so...
I'd be down for that.
And I know they confirmed that X-Men 97 and what was Spider-Man Freshman Year, which they're now calling something else, hits next year as well.
Oh, cool. That's good.
So, next year we might not have much in the way of movies,
but there will be some TV.
There will be some TV.
But it's weird to me how quiet X-Men 97 has overall been.
Yeah.
Like, I have not seen a bit of, like, art... Yeah. Or trailer, or announcements,
well,
or really anything.
It's been like almost like 2 years.
Yeah.
So
I mean, that pandemic stuff, fallout obviously is going to kick everybody's ass,
right?
And I got the impression that they were kind of trying to they were doing it right as in general. Yep. So the chances are it's probably going to still come off. It's just that's a bit long. Yeah.
Yeah. Another bit of casting news: Sean Gunn, who you may know as. What's his name?
A Nepo baby. For
he's in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes. Kraglin.
Yeah. You may know him as Kraglin. You might also know him as the body double for Rocket Raccoon.
Right.
You may or may not know that he's
Or if you've ever watched any James Gunn movie prior to the MCU, he's always in it.
He is James Gunn's brother, and he is going to play Maxwell Lord in the DCU. We don't know. He's going to show up in Superman Legacy, but apparently he will be a character throughout.
Right.
The article calls him a villain, but they don't really know. We don't know if he's been portrayed as a villain or as, like, you know.
I mean, he's probably going to be a villain.
Probably so.
Maxwell Lord, for those who don't know, was introduced in the 80s Justice League International thing.
Yep.
It was basically like the billionaire who funded the Justice League at the time.
He was a corporate raider. I don't think he was a billionaire.
Was he not?
No, he was a corporate. Okay. He was one of these corporate guys.
He was a little sleazy, but not like...
A little sleazy, but his heart was in the right place.
Right.
Until Greg Rucka revealed that he was a monstrous villain.
Yep, and like brainwashed Wonder Woman, had her like do a bunch of weird things.
He killed Blue Beetle.
He killed Blue Beetle
at the time. The Ted Kord Blue Beetle.
Shot. Anyway, I will never forgive Greg Rucka for either of those things.
Since been undone, but
not Maxwell Lord. Maxwell Lord was forever changed.
Just out of curiosity, did Maxwell Lord way back in the 80s? Wasn't he revealed at some point to have been a Manhunter during that weird crossover?
There was a like evil computer that was controlling him, and that it had forced him to create the Justice League.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
But he was a more decent... He was supposed to be a sleazy but decent guy.
You know, I just remembered, he had those mind push powers.
Yes,
he could give somebody a little push, he'd get a nosebleed. Yep. And generally what we saw is I think he would do it for somewhat good reasons, or he would be like slightly sleazy in a business deal.
And there was a little push. It wasn't like he couldn't fully mind control people. And then Rucka amped him up so he had these huge mind control powers.
He still had the bloody noses, though.
Still the bloody noses, yeah. Anyway,
yeah.
I blame Greg Rucka for ruining this character, and I hope that they do a different...
You know what it reminds me of? This is weird, but like, it wasn't uncommon somewhat in the 80s and some of the previous decades to have the wealthy benefactor types.
Yeah, yeah.
RJ Brand formed the Legion of Superheroes. Yep. He was a wealthy dude. And he was just... I know he's just like a PR flack, I think, but like Cameron Hodge helped form X-Factor.
Yep.
And that was...
He turned out to be evil.
Yeah, and they did that fast. It was like within a year they had revealed him to be evil. So he's been evil much, much longer than he was ever good. But I liked the character when he was just a, not unlike Maxwell Lord, a slightly sleazy, but maybe good for the team kind of guy. I think the lesson maybe here is that, like, cheap, oh, they were a villain all along reveals kind of suck.
Yeah.
If they you got to be doing a really good job to make that work.
You got to really earn it, and they've got to be a great villain. And Maxwell Lord is not a great villain.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He's an okay villain. He was a much better supporting character.
Yeah. Right.
Anyway, I'm curious to see what they do with him. I have a feeling they'll find a good niche. They used him in Supergirl, the Supergirl TV series.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Peter played him, and he was more of a good guy, actually.
Oh, I forgot about that. He did a good job.
The other thing you could do, and I think the thing is, you can't do good billionaires anymore, but wealthy benefactor is still a thing.
Sure.
Like, you can have someone be a wealthy patron who, like, has millions of dollars.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I wonder. I really have no idea how James. What is he going to appear in first?
Superman.
Well, Superman Legacy. We don't know. Collider's guessing.
Yeah.
Along with every other person that's been announced, going to show up in Superman.
Yeah. Superman's going to be a packed movie. I'm a little worried about it. But he could show up in the Creature Commandos for all we know. It's an animated
movie. I mean, that's true.
So, the next bit of news is mostly Greek to me, but y'all will be excited. Jordan Peele is joining Hideo Kojima on a new game.
So, yes. I think, Dave, you read an article. I kind of, like, skimmed it, but it's like...
I've already forgotten it all.
But it's like a game-movie hybrid, right?
Right. Well, actually, I don't... I was under the impression it's just a game. I posted a thing that was a joke that was, like, from one of those Onion-type places, Hard Times, about it being a hybrid. But I don't know that that's true.
Did you pull a prank on me? Is that what you're saying?
I believe you fell for the prank. But as a quick reminder to people, Hideo Kojima is the guy who created Metal Gear.
Yes.
And last he did was a weird... He's an auteur guy. He's always quirky and idiosyncratic. He likes to do those long cut scenes. His movies have weird meanderings on... I say movies. His games have long movies in them that are kind of meanderings on his own philosophies. Like
45-minute cut scenes.
Yep. A lot of people who play his stuff like kind of think he's a genius. Sometimes he'll do some stuff that annoys you. Yes, you're like, sometimes you're like, I want to play the game. Stop talking.
So Kojima describes it as an immersive and totally new style of game that will explore what it means to OD on fear.
It was Guillermo del Toro was going to do a Silent Hill with who was it? Was it Kojima?
Yes, it was.
And that got canceled. So this is maybe... And people were, like, still hurt about that because they put out a demo. I actually never played it, but apparently everybody loved that demo. You know about this, Nick?
I do. And it was, like, super, like... Yeah, they were super
immersive and creepy.
It.
And so, in a way, I think this is probably the closest thing we're going to get. He also did do the weird game Death Stranding, which is one of those games that I think people were kind of like, oh, this isn't Metal Gear, it sucks, it's a walking simulator.
But it's kind of...
But it kind of gained a cult following afterwards.
The world is really interesting.
It is a fascinating dystopia.
So the one sad part is that I see this is going to be an Xbox exclusive...
It's not like I have a PS5 either. It's all stuff I can't play.
That's true.
So what do I care?
I know, but that would make me want to purchase something. And I guess I could purchase an Xbox, but I don't know.
Do you have a PS5?
No.
So you would be in the same spot no matter what.
Yeah, no matter what.
Oh, okay.
But where Randy is like, oh, a Spider-Man game's coming out, I would like to buy that. A Jordan Peele Hideo Kojima. I mean, that's like a powerhouse.
I have a PS5 game, but I don't care about Hideo Kojima, so I win.
I guess. Your PS5 will gather dust, and your son will play it.
It won't get done. No time to gather dust.
He's gonna, I'm sure, play Baldur's Gate for a second time.
Yes.
You think he's only on the second one? But yeah, obviously, Jordan Peele is his own horror brand at this point.
Yep.
And he's, I know, always kind of doing other stuff. I think he's got like a, I think he's editing an anthology of horror stories, like a prose fiction thing. He did the new Twilight Zone. Like, he's always got a bunch of stuff going on. But most people these days, he's known for Get Out, Nope, and Us.
Yep.
All good horror movies to varying degrees.
Yep.
So yeah, I'm interested. Who knows? Maybe at some point I'll get another game system.
I mean, this will probably come out in 5 years. So we'll
get around to it. At that point, it'll be the future anyway, and we'll all be plugged into a virtual world.
Yeah, we'll just download
it on the games in our eyes.
Yep.
Yes.
While driving.
And our self-driving cars. That are going off cliffs.
Speaking of that, Twisted Metal is getting a season 2 at Peacock.
Did y'all both come around on that?
I did.
I really enjoyed Twisted Metal.
I remember we went from being excited about the trailers to...
the first couple episodes did nothing for me, and I thought, oh, this is crap.
Well, the first trailer was bad. Like, outright, none of the jokes landed.
I guess the ups and downs was, like, we knew the creative team first, and we're like, there's some good people involved.
Yeah.
But they didn't, like, not everything was a hit with them, so... And then, I guess, a weak trailer... And then we're like, oh, but the people are good. Maybe it'll still. And then there was y'all didn't like the early episodes, or maybe you
might have been. It took a few episodes to get into it.
As it goes on, it gets better. When you see that the first season is all setting up the actual Twisted Metal tournament.
So we're actually going to get a Twisted Metal tournament, which is fun.
It's probably good they're doing a second season because the first series was all set up.
Yes.
That is a little weird to me. Why would I want to watch something that's all set up?
It is a little weird. It works.
Is it still enjoyable?
Yes. It is, and I think it's because they want to have deeper characters. They want
say, the Mortal Kombat movie that was all set up for the tournament.
It's actually the opposite of it. You know how that doesn't work at all? This works.
Okay.
And it shouldn't.
Well, there's also a ton of world building. And it's not like surface. There's some really cool stuff.
It's still kind of a Road Warrior-ish world,
yes.
Right?
What they're doing is they're saying all the characters, they're doing foundation building so that they can tell more stories in the second season.
Yeah.
And they could have their car battle tournament without having to do a lot of like flashbacks to people not in cars battling.
Yes.
Right.
Which I think is probably smart. Yeah. It just means that they had to trust in people's patience, which almost didn't pay off for them.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
So you guys were around for season 2.
Yes, definitely. I'm definitely in.
Yeah. And the last thing is the trailer for the new Mr. and Mrs. Smith show on Prime.
Yep.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith is a movie from 15 years ago?
Somewhere in there, with Angelina
Brad
Jolie.
Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. I believe this is the one that broke up Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston.
Yep.
This is where they start cheating on each other and then got married. He got married to Angelina Jolie.
Yep.
Are they married still, or did they break up?
Oh, no, they broke up too.
Okay. Look at you gossips.
I actually found the movie to be really fun.
Remind me what the premise of Mr. and Mrs. Smith
is. So they are married. They're both secretly assassins. They don't know that each other is assassins. And then they get assigned to take each other out.
Okay.
And then they wind up sort of talking it out and working together against the cabal that's trying to...
Do the people who hired them not know that they were...
They did know. They just didn't... Maybe they find out, and that's when
they find out.
Each other out. Yeah.
Yep.
Now, so, jump ahead to the new show, and it is a bit of a different spin on
it's a very different premise. So, notably, it is Donald Glover starring in it, and he is also writing along with some of his Atlanta co-writers. It has a different, more mature vibe.
Yep.
The trailer does, and it is a... They are spies who are getting married for their cover.
Right.
Like, they are not in love. They know that they're spies. They're not assassins. And they're going to go on missions and probably fall in love, for real.
Probably so, yes. But it looked kind of grown up.
Like, this is what it's actually like to have the actual complications about relationships, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, it was still a stylish trailer. It was a little hard to know everything too much about it. But
they have to pretend to be a long-time married couple, even though they don't know each other that well. It feels a little bit more like what The Americans was doing.
Right.
Although The Americans
was
kind of
serious. Yeah.
This is a little lighter, more fun.
Yeah, probably so. And it looks like the guest cast is insane.
Spectacular. I saw Parker Posey. I saw Sarah Paulson.
John Turturro.
Ron Perlman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a lot of...
Ron Perlman would be in anything.
That's true.
I like Ron Perlman.
But yes.
It's easy. He's an easy get.
We can put him on the podcast next week.
Let's do it.
Ron Perlman's best comics of 2023. Yeah, so, yeah, this looked... I was skeptical, because as Dave noted, there have been, like, two or three True Lies clones.
Yeah, basically,
including True Lies TV show.
Right.
That have all been really disappointing.
And whatever that thing is with Mark Wahlberg.
Oh, that looks... Man, when I watch Apple Plus, sometimes... Yeah, I can hold a grudge.
There's a skip button, Randy.
I know, but I missed the skip button once, and I actually went back and restarted the trailer so I could skip it. Because I'm like, I'm not spending 2 minutes of my life watching this trailer to watch whatever I'm trying to watch. Monarch is what I was watching. I'm like, this is so horrible, I do not ever want to watch this trailer again.
I've skipped it 3 times because I'm watching Slow Horses.
Yeah.
I'm like, nope.
Every time it comes up, I reach for the skip button, and it goes away if you don't hit it immediately.
Bad wall.
I missed it, and I literally... rewound so I could make sure and skip it. Because I did not want to watch that trailer.
And yet.
I'm on board for this. Yeah.
Yep. Well, Donald Glover is kind of...
Donald Glover's a big draw.
Is a draw.
I don't have whatever streaming service it is anyway.
You don't have Prime?
No.
How do you get stuff from Amazon?
You can get stuff from Amazon without Prime.
Nope. You have to pay for it.
Yeah, that's true.
Remember, Dave still had the Netflix disc service for a long time after.
Oh, right. But you didn't hang on to it long enough to actually get into the discs they sent out, right?
If I had the funds for streaming services, I would get the streaming services.
That, I have Amazon Prime because of shipping stuff for Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
I order enough stuff. I try not to shop at Amazon for obvious reasons.
But I know y'all are big Bezos boosters.
Yep.
You're like, this guy needs more power and money.
There's stuff like... Honestly, there's medical stuff that is better to get from Amazon, and I hate it, but as a result, I get some stuff from them, and therefore it's worth having Prime, and that's why I have the Prime streaming service. I would not have Prime just for their streaming service, even though they've got some decent stuff.
Yeah.
The Boys, Gen V, Reacher.
Yeah.
I would definitely do the drop-in 1 month at a time kind of thing, but since I have the yearly shipping thing and it's just included, it's like a perk.
I'm excited. Reacher comes back on Friday.
Reacher comes back, yeah, Friday, that's right. Anyway... this is a good trailer. I'm excited for it.
I'm too.
Is that next year?
Yeah, it's I think February.
Nice. Okay, cool.
It's still too much everyday hitmen people. Like, I still a husband and wife shooting machine guns.
But they're spies. They're not assassins.
Oh god.
You love spies. Remember much like James Bond?
Sure. I know that I finally I even broke and I couldn't watch the last Mission Impossible.
Assassins and adjacent.
I still have. Yeah, it seems like it's growing. I still like watching people shoot things.
Why did we ever think Dave was going to watch The Killer?
No, The Killer I will actually watch.
But it's about National Assassin.
Because it's
David Fincher.
It's David Fincher.
Ah, okay.
And weirdly, it seemed less pop than some of these other things. I don't know if that's true or not, but it seemed like it was less pop.
Dave, you are to Assassins as Nick is to Zombies.
I guess so, yeah.
What's my thing? What's my genre that I don't do? Smart movies, I guess. movies that aren't made for dum-dums.
I have zombies and mobsters.
Oppenheimer is
my, yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Your kryptonite.
Smart and good movies. I don't do those.
You don't do biopics.
I don't do biopics. That's my thing.
Biopics.
I don't like biopics the same way Nick didn't like zombies and mobsters. I'm sure I have some other things. I just can't think of them off the top of my head.
Nick, the worst movie that Nick could ever see would be a zombie mobster movie.
Zombie mobster.
Oh, God.
Called Zombster.
That's all I got.
It's about the zombie birth of zombie Las Vegas.
Zombs for life.
But Nick did like the movie about zombies in Las Vegas.
Brainfellas.
Weirdly. From Zack Snyder.
Yes. Yes, sure.
2.5 stars worth.
Two and a half stars worth.
That's a whole lot of love.
Let's take a break, and then we're going to come back. We're talking about Godzilla and Samurais and Assassins. And the end of the world and Hot Wings. All right, we're going to start this week with the Big Lizard himself. Dave went and saw Godzilla Minus One.
That made it sound like I was the Big Lizard.
Dave is the Big Lizard.
Dave is?
Yeah. You know, Jim Morrison was the Lizard King. I'm the Big Lizard.
Dave's the Big Lizard.
I think you went along with, like, a couple million people saw this movie.
This is like a record-shattering movie, Godzilla Minus One. Mm-hmm. It's like the highest-grossing Japanese movie ever, biggest opening of, like, a... Japanese movie or vying for that with one other movie. Anyway, it went from being like a small release to now showing in more and more theaters, they're extending the release time so people may actually have a chance to see it.
Well, it's funny, before you talk about Godzilla Minus One, as a as a phenomenon, this is kind of like Barbenheimer, all those things that, like, just theaters have been struggling.
Yeah.
And I've seen at least one think piece of, like, maybe Hollywood needs to start looking outside to more foreign movies and that kind of thing.
Yep.
Because remember there was a piece a couple weeks ago about how basically the Christmas season, everyone was, like, counting on Aquaman 2 and that was it. There's, like, nothing coming out.
Right.
And all of a sudden, Godzilla Minus One is, like, the savior of theaters.
Yeah.
And it's one of these things, like, they never could have planned for it.
Right.
Right. It seems like, but, you know, studios always seem to take the wrong lessons from things.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to be like, let's bring over all the Godzilla movies, not like, let's look to more interesting foreign films. You know, with Barbie, they didn't think, oh, let's do more idiosyncratic, auteur-driven, women-directed movies. They thought, let's make a bunch of fucking toy movies. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's
funny. They're incredibly stupid.
My wife sees maybe 2 or 3 movies a year.
Yeah.
She once saw this.
Did she have the Godzilla love?
Not really. Okay. But she has a group that they do, like, monster movies that they watch sometimes.
Yeah.
They had watched a Godzilla movie or something, so they had talked about it. So it's like her social group.
Interesting, yeah, yeah.
Did you agree that this is a, as many people have said, a good movie?
Yes, it definitely is a good movie. Although, you know, weirdly, I think the Godzilla style, like, concept of the Legendary Ones better, where he's, like, largely indifferent to humanity, but maybe every once in a while is, like, kind of on our side for whatever reason.
Yeah. Right.
You know, even if it's his own reason.
That was the Marvel style, too.
Where, what's that?
That was the Marvel version of him,
too. In the comics? Yeah, yeah. Whereas the Godzilla Minus One is definitely, Godzilla is a calamity. Nothing good about him. You just want to try and stop him, get away from him, etc., etc. He's going to kill many
people. It seems weird the Japanese people might think of anything atomic powered as a dangerous thing that could cause destruction.
Right.
But you know what? So, you know what? I know there's, like, books written about this.
Yeah.
But there is also something about, like, at a certain point when Godzilla became so popular, and they did start doing those, you know, kind of like this somewhat campier Godzillas where he was, like, the hero sometimes.
Yep, yep.
Then you can almost view it as the way of reclaiming, you know, the idea. And it's like, oh, now Godzilla's our symbol. We've taken this symbol of, you know, nuclear paranoia and fear and loss and tragedy, and now he's a hero.
It's weirdly, for me, the setting is the most interesting aspect of this.
Sure.
That it's basically a post-World War II...
If I'm not mistaken,
which
Godzilla...
you're not really seeing Japan.
Godzilla, the original Godzilla, I think, was 1954 or 56, something like that.
Yeah.
So this is actually set before that, and I think kind of functions roughly as a prequel to that.
Okay.
I'm not sure about... No, because, like, there is... you know, he makes mainland in this, and he blows some shit up.
Right,
right.
And, like, that's not discussed in the original Godzilla. So this almost just presupposes, I guess, an earlier encounter with him.
Yeah.
And so here's what I'm going to try and be as spoiler-free as I can on this, and just I'll just kind of talk about, like, the setup.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a cool setup. It starts on an island that has, like, this little small airstrip, and it's the tail end of the war. And you will figure out that this plane that seemingly has come limping home is a kamikaze pilot. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, I couldn't make it. You know, I had, trouble, what do you call it? Engine trouble or whatever, some kind of mechanical trouble. And he gets out and they're like looking it over. And one of the mechanics comes up and like, he's like, huh, we can't seem to find what's wrong with it. You sure it was the engine? Mm-hmm. And what this guy has weighing on him is that he, couldn't go through with it. And that is followed shortly by a... although this is very character-centric for, I'm going to say maybe 45 minutes after that, in some very interesting ways. For once... there's actually some very interesting human stuff in it. Like really very interesting and, like, very approachable characters, smartly written. But Godzilla does show within the first 10 minutes. And the interesting thing is he's, like, smaller. He's, like, it's like he hasn't formed fully yet.
Oh.
So imagine something maybe, like, twice the size of a T-Rex.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit bigger than that, but nowhere near, like, the building size that he will become.
This means he was... tiny Godzilla at some point.
He was, yeah. And What will ultimately happen is this guy will return to the mainland with the weight of both what happens on the island with Godzilla, which I don't want to quite say too much about, and the weight of, in his eyes, being essentially a coward who could not go through with it. Even though one of the other guys, there's some nuance to the writing in this. One of the other guys recognizes, he like comes up to him. He hasn't acknowledged what he's done at that point on the island. But this guy comes up and he's like, "You did the right thing." He's like, "The war is basically over. Everybody knows what way it's going to go, and you would just become one more body added to the count." So he's like, "You did the right thing." But he doesn't feel that way. And when he goes home to his like bombed out home, which is like barely standing, he's lost most of his family. There's a neighbor who was like, oh, if she sees him, and at first she's like, "Oh, it's so good to see you. You made it," or whatever. And she's like, "Wait." She's like, "You were in the, you know, Air Force or whatever. You were supposed to be a kamikaze pilot." And he has this look of shame on his face, and she very quickly figures out what it is, and she, like, slaps him.
Oh, wow.
She's, like, disgusted with him.
Huh.
And that is, you know, it's that Japanese ethos of... not just, I mean, of self-sacrifice, but also the very specific pressures of World War II. And what starts coming together, and like, I know this is going to sound boring, but he starts trying to rebuild his life. And he like runs into this, he ends up sharing a house with a woman who is like a sort of a war survivor, but who is like a thief. Who had picked up herself a kid that wasn't her own, not biologically hers, but just, like, found in the rubble somewhere.
Dave, quick interruption. Is this the same people that made Shin Godzilla?
I don't think so.
Because isn't that also sort of, like, around the humanity surrounding Godzilla as much as anything
else? I'm
pretty
sure this is not them. This is a guy that's been wanting to do this story for a long time.
This sounds very, very human-centric, because I know a lot of people complain about with Godzilla.
It is, and so I don't know on Shin Godzilla. Okay. I actually know very little about that.
Yeah.
So I can't say.
But like, it sounds like it's very human-centric in a lot of it. There's not.
It is. Like, you wouldn't, although, like, then, like, huge chunks of it are Godzilla-ish. They spend a lot of time with these characters, and like very quickly he's kind of has like his kind of post-war found family.
Okay.
And I actually like came to really love these characters. They're, you know, man, the characters in the legendary movies are all just like, okay, sometimes I like this or that actor, I'll like this or that scene, but they're all kind of a little bit, nobody's like, oh, I love that character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of characters in this where I'm like, I love this character.
Yeah, they're unfortunately a lot of like surface level kind of things.
Yeah.
There's nothing to really kind of
the writing is just better in this.
Yeah.
It's not that it's like super nuanced, it's still pretty like mainstream, you know. It actually reminds me a little bit of like almost weirdly the way James Cameron sketched out characters in his good 80s movies,
yeah,
like The Abyss,
yeah,
and Aliens,
okay,
and
yeah,
stuff like that.
I get that.
Like, yeah, you're not going to learn all these details, but you're going to like them pretty instantly.
Okay.
And you're not going to be like, oh, this one's the villain of the piece, because there's not an obvious villain in that sense. But there is a little bit of interesting philosophy about like the nature of Japan as it relates to the United States, as it relates to its own government and the people, the average civilian. How they feel about that after the war. That's all stuff I think it's most interesting to kind of see how the movie does it. And then there is a Godzilla as catalyst for a lot of character development, loss, sadness, and heroics and things in the second half of the movie where, you know, at this point you're very attached to everybody.
Yeah,
I feel at least. And
yeah.
I felt like the audience was there too. And Godzilla is truly monstrous. It's in kind of ways I don't want to quite say how, but
I have heard that he is scary. That they do the point of view stuff and they make him
scary. I feel
scary.
Like he's not scary in the sense that maybe some people are saying like as in horror movie scary, but he's scary the way like, you know, nuclear weapons are scary.
Are you telling me he doesn't do like jump scares?
He does not jump scare.
I want to ask you a question though.
Yeah.
How are the effects? Because I know that the budget on this is only like $15 million.
Right, and I think I even heard the director say something like, he's like, oh yeah, that number's wrong too. He's like, we wish we had $15
million. Oh, okay. that's even more rare.
Yeah, no, I haven't vetted that, but that's what I saw that somewhere.
But the effects are...
are quite good, occasionally a little CG-ish.
Okay.
They are, you know, it's one of those things, I'm not that bothered by slightly lesser effects if the story is there.
Right.
And sometimes the effects are A-list, I think. You know, like Jurassic Park, A-list.
Yeah.
But every once in a while you're like, yeah, that's kind of CG-ish a little bit. I'm going to say better than the ending of Black Panther, but... But not without a little bit of it. And I even had a few story points that I thought were like, you know, I was like, oh, that's a little weaker, or that part was a little predictable or whatever. But by and large, I did not know where this movie was going as I was following it.
Okay.
I had, there's some big emotions in it at least two or three times, you know, where you'll feel the heartstrings tug.
Is it dubbed or is it
subtitled?
It is subtitled. Okay.
So yeah, and I would honestly, I would say if at all possible, see it subtitled. I can tell these actors are doing a damn good job, and they're gonna. It's just gonna come through more when you get to hear them say the actual lines in Japanese.
Is this one of those things that you really want to see on a big screen, or does it would it work on a smaller screen?
I think it'll work on a smaller screen, okay. But
I don't think I'm gonna get out. To
yeah,
the
I don't get a chance to see the theater. See
it. They're extending it though.
I know, but
here's the thing: is like if you can, I would say see it in the theater because it has some of that Oppenheimer. Kabam to it, you know.
I don't watch Oppenheimer on my phone, so
Christopher Nolan's not going to care. Yeah, I think he's outright said that he doesn't care.
That's because he's just clever about PR. But you know, in the middle of the night, he's up.
It'll kill
he's
him.
Sweating bullets. Anyway,
Randy is watching it on his phone.
I'll be very interested when y'all catch it. We'll do a follow up to this, but I would say. I'm a casual Godzilla fan. I do prefer the legendary style, and I guess I don't watch enough of these to say, but I know he's been a quasi-hero before in the Toho films.
Yeah.
But this is probably the best Godzilla movie. That's just flat out it. Okay. It's I would say it's better than 95% to 99% of the other
ones.
That is
what I'm hearing from the Godzilla fanatics as well.
Yep. And I just don't quite want to put it on a pedestal because I don't think it's without a few criticisms, but it's really good.
Cool. Staying in Japan, although not Japanese, have Blue Eye Samurai.
Correct.
Which I did not realize is a French-American series.
Yes.
Excuse Randy, first you watch One Piece.
I know, action. Right? I'm becoming an anime
You're fiend. A big anime fiend.
So this is, Michael Green is one of the people behind it.
Who's that?
So this was interesting. Look at it. So he wrote all three of the Kenneth Branagh Murder on the Orient Express.
Okay.
So he wrote those. He did the screenplay for Blade Runner 2049. He did the screenplay for Alien Covenant. He did the screenplay for Logan. He did the screenplay for Green Lantern.
So that was checkered
record.
Jungle Cruise, which I know some in this room might put as a positive. Some of us put them a negative.
Classic checkered record.
But Blue Eye Samurai is definitely one of his hits.
This is an 8-episode series.
It's like an action adventure thing that's like a period piece, like in samurai times.
It is set during Edo period or Edo period Japan, where they start at the beginning with a sort of not narration. It is like a title card,
right?
It basically said that in this period they become so isolationist there are like no white people in Japan.
They've closed their borders. They basically locked it down.
Yeah, but more so than that, like basically if you are mixed race, if you have like blue eyes,
right,
you are seen as like a demon and a monster.
Yep.
Like it's a weird racism, which is the foundation of it because the character is has a white father.
Yep.
That they don't know. And they're on a quest to kill the four white men remaining in Japan.
Yeah, one of them
is probably their father and took advantage of their mother.
This sounds, I don't want to say like so problematic, but just so like, it feels like it's like, it makes me nervous just talking about it.
Yeah.
And yet I've only heard good stuff about this, so it must be handled okay.
It's handled very well. It's a good, that's the baseline of it. But basically, what you've got is.
But this isn't some movie about like poor white people.
No, you've
right?
got like you've oh, got no. A, no, no,
no, God, no. No.
He is very much a man with no name kind of character.
Yeah, yeah.
Wears a hat, like a big wide brim hat,
and sunglasses.
And sunglasses to hide the blue eyes.
Well, they're tinted brown.
Yeah.
To hide that.
And. The first thing we see of Blue Eye Samurai is fighting a flesh peddler in a tavern.
Yep.
And he just goes to town on him.
Yep.
The The fight sequences in this are, I think they're motion captured.
You were telling me that, and that makes sense. But they're really
stunning.
They are. They're really good.
Is it the first episode where he goes up against the school, like the swords, the samurai school?
It might be the second episode. Now that
but
I think
he goes
about
in
it.
And basically he's looking for this master, and the people who run into him are really great. They're real arrogant. And they point him to a brothel instead.
Uh-huh.
And then he finds the school, and he basically winds up fighting his way through this entire samurai school. And at the same time, we're seeing a flashback of him being orphaned at a young age, meeting a blind blacksmith who he learns blacksmithing from,
okay.
And makes this sword from a meteorite that fell.
Yep.
So it's like
he's a sword maker. He's not just a black, just like a random blacksmith. Yeah, he's a well renowned.
He's got that. What's the Kill Bill guy?
Tori
Hanzo.
Tori Hanzo.
Yes,
it's definitely a Tori Hanzo type guy.
Yeah,
there are things here that are sort of classical riffs on stuff we've seen before, but it's sort of just all in the execution.
Yeah,
it's gorgeous. The voice acting is amazing.
Voice acting is really stunning.
They've stacked it because I mean Kenneth Branagh is the villain. And he does a fantastic job as kind of this sinister.
Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah. There's a plot going on. He's a gun dealer. He's dealing in Western guns.
That sounds
and
cool.
And he is basically planning to help overthrow the Shogun.
Yeah. But I mean, like Randall Park, Ming-Na Wen plays kind of a geisha.
Yep.
Basically the head of a geisha house. George Takei is in here.
How much of it is drama and how much is action?
It's
an action
50-50,
show.
But
it's a good split.
But it definitely has an emotional story through.
I would say that it's one of those things where yes, the action is going to be the draw, but they do not they go out of their way to make these characters something you care about.
There's four notable characters. I mean, there's a lot of notable characters, but the main stories are about Mizu, our blue-eyed samurai.
Yep.
Akemi, who is a girl who is she's a princess to be betrothed to the son of the Shogun. But she is already in love with this other guy, Taigen, who's a samurai who's trying to be worthy of her. And Taigen falls afoul of Mizu in the first episode, and then they wind up in sort of a frenemy situation.
Okay.
And then there's a... is Randall Park playing Heiji? Is Heiji... No.
No, then there's the apprentice, which is Masioko.
Masioko.
Yes.
From Heroes.
From Heroes.
He's playing Ringo, a boy... I mean, he's like 20...
Yeah,
he has no hands. He has congenital defects with no hands, and he works in like a soup shop with his father, and he basically apprentices himself to Mizu.
Okay,
and so it's his story. He is very much the likable sidekick, the decent person.
Yeah.
In the midst of it. He's not a badass like everybody else, but he's nice. But Akemi basically runs away from home and falls in with a brothel owner.
Yeah,
and. And so her story is being told. Taigen, who is another sort of Ronin, is being told. And they all sort of come together in this big story. It's a really expansive story. I am not always a big samurai story guy, but this really wrapped me into it. And the action is just the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
Let me just quick ask. Is this a somewhat realistic? I mean, I'm sure the swordplay is heightened, but otherwise kind of realistic?
Yes.
Somewhat. It's, I would say, more melodrama than drama.
Okay.
Yeah.
It definitely has that sort of, like, the romance and stuff is all very melodramatic.
But there's no, like, overt magic.
Yeah, there's no magic.
No dragons.
No, it is very much like a person who's just a really damn good swordsman.
And Nick, did you like it as well?
Yeah, I loved it.
Are y'all both done with it?
Yeah. I watched all 8 episodes.
And Netflix just announced that they're doing season two,
yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I think I'll probably try and check
it out. I think you'll like it because you really enjoyed the video game. Why am I blanking on its name?
Ghost of Tsushima.
Yeah.
And I think there's going to be aspects of this, like the action is what I've watched of play of that.
And that was broadly a realistic game, too. I think it dabbled just a little bit in some
It fits into those kind of...
Like, half of my friends were talking about this, a lot of my anime artist friends are like, this is the best show of the year. Which I wouldn't go that far.
I don't know if I'd go that far.
But it's possibly in my top 10. It might get there. Might get my top 20. I don't know, it's been a good year for TV.
It's been a great year.
Yeah. It ain't The Bear. The Bear might be the best show on TV.
The Bear is.
But One Piece is the best show on TV.
One Piece is up there.
One Piece might be
in
the top 10.
One Piece is in my top 5, I think.
Oh, it's in the top 5.
I think it's in my top 5.
I need to sit down. Those are lists
it's top 5 or top 10, but it's...
The thing about One Piece, and I don't watch TV like y'all do, but like... I feel like I could think of, like, if with a little bit of work, I'd have to sit down and think about it a little bit, but I could come up with, like, 20 amazing, cool scenes
yeah.
in it.
Yeah.
Pretty
yeah.
easily.
Yeah.
Like, you know the dude who's, like, the pirate hunter?
Yeah, yeah.
Just that first scene of him where he's, like, at a, was it, like, a grave or something like that, and that guy comes up to kill him?
Yeah.
Which was, I believe, an invented scene that was all yeah, yeah. made up. But I was like, that was man, cool. that was a dope intro.
Yep, yep. Nick and I both watched a couple other Netflix movies.
Yes.
We watched The Killer,
yep.
which is based on a show that, if you go back to this podcast, the very, very early episodes, it might not even Comic Pants, actually.
It might have been, but it was...
But it's a graphic novel, European graphic novel by Mats and Luc Jacquemont.
Yep,
yep.
And it is about a sociopathic assassin.
Yep. With little running narration from him that kind of shows you how he sees the world.
And how he justifies what he does for a living.
Right. He's kind of nihilistic, doesn't particularly have any sense of empathy, but
he's like a he like talking about Nietzsche and philosophy and stuff. Like
right.
He has really thought through why he can do this kind of stuff.
Right. And yet, it's also like you're reading it and you're like, you're a weird alien man.
Yeah. But it was very, very good. I don't think anyone has finished it.
No.
Yeah.
But,
and they've done multiple volumes.
It's now all available as one volume, which I don't think we have. We should probably get in.
Yeah,
yeah. Jump ahead and.
But this story
Fincher
is
Fincher has taken the filtered, part of that
filtered by David Fincher,
right?
Yeah. And it stars Michael Fassbender,
yes,
as the killer. What's interesting is I watched this, Nick, and I felt like it absolutely felt like the atmosphere and the pacing of the graphic novel mm-hmm. was there, but his monologue, which is really interesting, is cut down a bit, so it's like kind of a few repeated things.
Yeah.
As opposed to the sort of rambling, philosophical
there's a little
killer,
more focus.
Which makes sense, but I kind of missed the more rambling stuff from the comics. I do think, of the two mediums, I think the comic did it better.
Yeah.
But this is an excellent movie.
I think Fassbender did an amazing job with this character, yeah. which is a kind of also surface character
yeah.
in a lot of ways.
The
weird thing is, to some degree, I think sociopaths are actually somewhat
yeah.
flat characters
yeah.
because they're weird. They don't have normal human emotions.
But he's also
the plot of this, the pitch of this scene is very simple. It is an assassination goes wrong, and the blowback hits him personally, and
yep.
so he goes out to punish the people who hurt him.
Yes.
That's the entire story. Like, this is not unlike Taken or...
Right.
No.
You got
Man
a simple
on fire,
hook.
Or it's a simple hook. But it's got an approach that's more...
Fincher's very meticulous
yeah.
about everything he does and everything from the music he listens... This character
this
listens to.
This guy loves the Smiths.
That is the soundtrack, is the Smiths. And the action... This is some of, like, the... I honestly think this might be some of the grandest action David Fincher has ever done.
Yeah. It reminds me a little of what Mann did with Collateral.
Well, he's not usually yeah. an action guy. He's fantastic at suspense.
Yeah.
Well,
there's a sequence that is just a straight-up action scene that
yeah.
I was like, damn.
Yeah, there's a brutal fight scene in this that's
okay.
really, really well done.
But then there's a scene with Tilda Swinton.
That scene
and
with him and Tilda Swinton is the highlight of this movie for me.
Yeah, I also like the scene with the lawyer. There's so many different sequences, and
yeah.
also just little bits of dialogue that Fassbender just like spouts off that
yeah.
I'm like... Holy shit, that was funny.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of like commonplace, just happenstance.
It's really gripping. It's an easy watch. I dug this.
Yeah, I really...
My only gripe about it is that they took a pretty elaborate story and simplified it down to one... But it's a movie. You got to do that.
Yeah. I mean, who's to say that Fincher won't come back for another one?
Yeah.
He might.
He likes murder stories.
He does.
The other movie we watched is called Leave the World Behind.
Yep.
It's written and directed by Sam Esmail from Mr. Robot.
It is adapted from an actual novel.
Adapted from a novel. Of the two, is there really an apocalypse going on? Or are these strangers who came to our vacation home con men movies that happened this year?
Yes.
This is my second favorite. And that's
that
not a lot.
Knock at the
that's,
Cabin?
That's not a lot, but it's weird that it happened twice. yes, that is Knock at the Cabin. I like Knock at the Cabin better than this.
And I reverse it. I actually like Leave the World Behind
a bit more.
They're
different movies.
They are.
But it is the same genre, right? Like,
it is.
Weirdly.
That is weird.
But it's...
This maybe is telling us something about society.
Also adapted from a novel, by the way. So.
But I will say that the Leave the World Behind removes the sort of mysticism.
Yes.
And replaces it with, like a hacker attack.
Well, yeah, it's because if Shyamalan made this and Esmail made that, I mean, it's the filmmaker's personality coming through in the adaptation.
I think I like Leave the World Behind scenes a little bit more. I not to say that Knock at the Cabin didn't have good acting and stuff like that, because I think. But when you throw in Julia Roberts, Mahershala Ali.
You have Julia Roberts and Mahershala Ali playing against each other, and that's pretty great.
And Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hawke's great in it, too. Kevin Bacon. In his sort of small role is really good.
Yeah, that's a pretty high level of actors. even though the actors in Knock at the Cabin are no slouch.
Yeah, they're pretty good, yeah.
Let me ask this real quick. Knock at the Cabin drew its central tension from a question of whether this couple, whether they could believe this insane cult that seemed like it might be right about the world ending.
Yeah.
But, like, there was, you were like, I don't know if this is real. Is this magic? Is this an end times prophecy? Do you know what's going on?
No. This is a little more grounded, though. So basically what this starts is, Julia Roberts is deliberately unlikable. Esmail talked about this in an interview that he made her a very unlikable Karen type, basically.
Yeah, she does a great job with it.
She starts the movie, she and Ethan Hawke in their, like, New York apartment, and she's talking about, you know, she's watching all the people go about their lives, and it seems like she's about to make this point about how wonderful humanity
is.
You know what I realized? I hate people. That's her thing from the out. Like, she fucking hates people. She doesn't want to be around anybody. And so it's her... It's this couple. He, like, books a vacation home for them. So they go out to this, like, island vacation home. This really nice mansion-type thing with a pool and all that. And they take their two kids. One is a 17-year-old boy, I think, maybe?
Yeah, 16. 18,
16, somewhere in that ballpark. And a newly 13-year-old girl who's obsessed with watching Friends.
Yep.
which is hilarious to me because Julia Roberts is in Friends.
Yes, she is.
They don't ever make a joke.
No.
It's not that kind of movie. But I thought about it the entire time. but they go out to this vacation and they're having their vacation thing, and then the internet's being weird, cell phones are being weird, and in the middle of the night, Mahershala Ali and his daughter, who is like 20, 22 maybe.
Yep.
They show up in like tuxes and dress, like fancy. And tell them that they were in New York. There was a big blackout, and that he's the owner of this home. That it's like a Verbo or one of those things.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, so we decided to come here. You know, we just wanted to stay here. And she's having none of it. She's like, I don't even know who this guy is.
Yeah.
She's like, we've never talked. Like, I exchange emails, but I don't know.
She and her husband have like polar opposite reactions.
Yeah. He's like, of course. And the thing is, like, I'm watching this and I'm thinking, most people would be like understanding. These people, they're in a luxury car. They're in the, like, if they're con men,
it's an elaborate con. But there is that tension, though, that they might be doing something.
Just a little bit of a barbarian to this.
Yeah, there's a little bit of barbarian to it. Yeah, but very quickly you start seeing that weird shit is going on.
Yes,
But they don't tell you what it is until the very like last closing minutes of the movie.
Oh, animals are behaving erratically.
There's a very effective scene where like 100 deer are outside and only the 13-year-old sees it.
There's also a scene that I don't know if I've ever seen in a movie involving an oil tanker.
Yeah, that was really good. That was in the trailer,
but it's...
They've gotten some pretty nice good with some of their special effects and stuff these days.
Yeah.
The planes falling out of the sky in Knock at the Cabin were one of those... And I feel like there's something else I saw in some other movie. I'm blanking on it now. But I was just like, some of these are kind of rather disturbing.
You know,
weirdly, I remember seeing the trailer for this, and I think I was like, I don't know if I was just in a bad mood or whatever, but I was like, God, it looks depressing. Like,
it is depressing.
It is, and I kind of wanted to write it off a little bit as like, oh, I kind of enjoyed that, but I don't know if they landed the... Like, literally, like, ended it where I wanted it to.
Yeah, yeah.
But the more, it's hung on.
Okay.
It's, like, stuck with me.
And I think I landed in a different place.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I liked it okay. I feel like they took way too long to tell me what was going on. And I think ending it where they did it was a mistake.
But removing technology from kind of, like, from us as a people.
Yeah.
And now we're kind of, like... We're socially, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, and that's how we interact with individuals instead of not interacting, like, with actual person-to-person.
Yeah.
It's an interesting idea.
To me, I've watched Mr. Robot, and I've seen this, and I think Sam Esmail comes across to me as a person who is scared of technology, but also, like, addicted to it, because...
Yeah.
I didn't buy his premise here. I did not think that the way to taking out technology the way that... His, like, scary hackers, I'm like, I don't buy that this could happen. And that was a big part problem for me. It's like, this doesn't scare me because it seems so implausible the way it's presented. And the same way his people, Like, I understand that people are assholes. Like, I totally get that. But the way that everybody turns paranoid and turns selfish, I was like, there's no one here who's thinking of the greater good in any of these
but
dozen
I mean,
people.
That's something we've seen in all kind of apocalypse.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I guess, Walking Dead.
But Walking Dead shows people band together. When there's actually natural disasters, a lot of people band together.
Yeah, that is the thing. It felt to me like Esmail's dislike of humanity and distrust of technology overwhelmed the story a little bit for me. I'm not saying it's bad, but for me, that's why it didn't fully connect.
I don't think I bought into it.
Yeah,
it's kind of thing.
Sure.
Nick's over here like, humanity is shit.
Well, no, it was just for this family, because we've already seen that Julia Roberts hates people.
Well, Julia Roberts, I just thought, was an interesting character. They did a great, I mean, he talked about casting Julia Roberts, because, like, you have to cast someone who you love.
Well, he's worked with her three times.
You have to cast someone to really sell this unlikable protagonist in a way where you just don't want to turn the thing off.
Right.
Right.
And she does a great job of it because she's unlikable, borderline racist.
Yeah.
And yet, they managed to make her come around, and you like her, and I think that's a lot of that is down to Julia Roberts.
Yeah.
But her and Mahershala Ali interacting, everything with them is great. The scene that really stuck with me is the bit with Ethan Hawke, who is like the nice guy.
Yep.
There's a point where there's a woman who he's driving around trying to find the town, and he's got no GPS,
so he can't.
And he can't find. He's basically lost.
Yeah.
And a woman comes up to him, hysterical and yelling in Spanish.
Yep.
And he just leaves her.
Yeah. He
and
can't.
I'm like, man, that is hard to watch, and he feels guilty about it. But I'm like, in that situation, I'm like, man, what do you do?
Right.
You don't want to let a person who might be crazy in your car at that point.
Correct.
But at the same time, I'm like, man, I don't think I could have done that.
I don't know.
Like that. I'm like, that was very effective. There's several things like that. And then when Kevin Bacon has what is basically a cameo appearance.
Yeah.
There's a great character piece when they do that.
There's also a sequence that I had a hard time watching.
Yeah.
The teeth.
Oh, yeah. Yikes.
I was
like,
holy shit, I don't think I've ever seen... Nope, don't like.
Yeah.
Can I ask what that is, or should I wait
and
see it?
No, you should see it.
Okay.
This is definitely worth watching. It's lower on my favorite movie list, but it's been a good year for movies.
Yeah.
Like, this was a solid movie. I don't regret watching it. I think it's a little overlong, and I think it lost a little bit for me. I'm almost glad, because if this had landed for me a little harder, I think it would have freaked me out more.
Yeah.
But I don't... I could easily dismiss this as... It's not going to go down that way. Whereas I think Esmail is trying to sell me on this is how the world's going to end. And I'm like, I don't know that I believe this.
Yeah, I don't know if I didn't buy it as like, this could actually happen. I don't have that doom prepper in me.
Yeah.
Even though my wife does.
It's good. It's good to have one in the couple who's got the doomsday bunker.
I don't believe that humanity would collapse that quickly.
Same.
But this does portray an interesting kind of, like, alternate world kind of thing that I was able to be like, okay, I can buy this.
Yeah.
And it is creepy.
Yeah.
I thought the special effects were quite good
when
they used them.
Yeah.
But it was down to the characters and
also,
just the scenes.
Knock at the Cabin is a little more in that sort of supernatural weird vein. This is very grounded.
Yeah.
It has some weird stuff with the animals and the noises and that kind of thing. But there's never a thought of like, oh, what is it? What is it, aliens or anything? No, it's obviously a man-made disaster.
Yeah.
I'm
curious to check this out and get back and tell audiences the right reaction.
Which one of us is right.
Yeah.
Which of us is right and which of us is dead. Oh, it's funny, Nick. I don't know what you rated this on Letterboxd.
I think I gave it a 3 stars, but I hearted it.
That's funny. I also gave it 3 stars. So we're not that far apart.
I also did watch the other Netflix movie, the May December.
Oh yeah,
With Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman, which is a bizarre movie. It's a quiet like drama about a woman who starts a relationship she is like a teacher or not a teacher, but she's like a 40-year-old starts a relationship with like a 13-year-old.
It is
bizarre, but they've progressed the story where the kid is now 30. He has 2 kids that are like graduating, and Natalie Portman plays an actress who comes in to sort of research a role for the movie, the inevitable movie. It is odd.
Yeah, that sounds odd.
Julianne Moore. They all do great performances. I know that a lot of these people are going to get nominated. Natalie Portman.
What's this movie called?
May December.
Okay.
I don't know if this is going to be for everybody. It's a
for
weird.
Everybody.
I mean, this is
with
based
a plot
on like
that. I can tell universal appeal.
Yeah, everybody loves.
I mean,
everybody loves groomers.
It is based on an actual story. I mean, an actual real life, real world event, and a couple of them just kind of meshes things.
The life of Woody Allen.
I mean, but. I found myself kind of.
Does it all take place after this has already happened?
Yes, it takes place in the present where this has already happened.
He's in his thirties.
He's in his thirties. Yep. He's dealing with teenage kids.
It worked out just like it did for Al
Alan Alda.
But what did you just say? Woody Allen.
Yeah. I said Alan Alda.
But the character moments are really interesting. The kid who plays the father is from Riverdale. He plays Reggie, right. I think.
Okay.
And he gives a performance that I could not expect from somebody on Riverdale. Not to knock them, but
okay.
I was very impressed. Natalie Portman also won me over. She plays kind of a sleazy actress, but does it really, really well. Huh. Like, a bit over the top. But, like I said, I don't know if it's going to be for everybody. I think a lot of people will watch the first 10 minutes and then opt out.
I've definitely seen some friends who hated it.
Yeah, and I think that is the reaction. I tend to stick with movies, and I think I gave this 3.5 stars, weirdly.
Wow, is it better than...
I did, because it also stuck with me. I think character drama and like the performances and what characters... how they're affected by something as weird as this was an interesting...
Sure. It is the world we live in.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It is very odd.
So, what's the best movie you saw in the last few weeks? Or last week or whatever?
Of the ones we just talked about?
Yeah.
I like The Killer Bird and The Life of World Behind.
Okay, and Nick, your favorite of them?
I think favorite is maybe May, December, but I think the most watchable is Leave the World Behind.
Okay.
I think it is a good movie that should be watched.
And I've only seen Godzilla, so it's all I have to go on.
I mean, probably Godzilla is better than all
in
of them.
and that's a weird week to be able to say that.
Yeah.
But I think on Letterboxd, I maybe did give it 4 stars.
Of all the stuff we just talked about, Samurai is my favorite thing.
Samurai
is great. But I think...
that's because you'll never shut up about anime, Randy.
I do love anime so much. Yeah, yeah. But my favorite movie that I watched is one we haven't actually talked about. We were waiting to see if Nick was going to finish it, and that's The Drop.
I'm not going to finish it. You guys should talk about it.
That's a movie from 2014.
Yep.
And I don't want to say too much about it, honestly. It just went off HBO Max.
The very reason we wanted Nick to finish watching it is because there are some turns here and there that really make it.
But... it is one of those things, it almost is pointless to promote too much because you have to buy it on DVD or Blu-ray now. It's like not,
right.
Or digital, but you can't, it's not streaming anymore.
There's a few key things you watch it for. You watch it this because it's a low-key kind of crime suspense movie with...
It's got Tom Hardy and James Gandolfini. And Noomi Rapace.
Yep.
And it's based on a short story or a novella...
By Dennis Lehane. Who writes the screenplay as well, I think.
He writes the screenplay, and who also did Shutter Island, and also Mystic River. He's heavily adapted in Hollywood for crime stories that are kind of...
very depressing stories.
It's a depressing story.
It is, and yet...
And yet, well, to give people the premise, which is what, Dave, what you gave me before I watched it, it was enough to get me to watch it.
Yeah.
The Drop refers to... They're these gangsters from... they're Chechnyan, right?
I think so.
And they do a... basically, they all their money from their legal operations, bookmaking and extortion, whatever they're doing, drops at various neighborhood bars.
Yep.
You never know if your bars... You know, if you're in with these guys, you know that you're a possible drop location.
And the money gets laundered through them.
They're going to tell you, like, on the day that you're the drop location.
Yeah.
Right.
And so Tom Hardy plays a bartender... at this bar that is owned by James Gandolfini, that is one of the drop locations, and there it looks, and then they get robbed,
right
before a drop happens, I think, or is it right after the drop happens?
I believe
it's the Chechens, like
it's before the drop because the main drop
is the big thing. But
yes.
I think there is like. It is somehow their money, because the Chechens come around looking for their money.
It's essentially their bar.
Yeah.
They own it.
So there's a robbery that happens, and then there's, like, a bigger robbery happening. And Tom Hardy, meanwhile, has this sort of meet-cute with a neighbor, a female neighbor.
Over a dog.
Over a dog who's been left in a trash can, and there's, like, an abusive ex-boyfriend. And there's a lot of sort of story stuff going on, and you will see how it all coalesces at the end.
Right. And Tom Hardy plays... He's a guy who I felt like was in over his head right from the
beginning.
He
feels a little bit like a dumb guy.
He's kind of a dumb guy. It's not unlike, in some ways, the sort of sad sack character that Rocky was in the first movie.
Yeah.
Like, a real,
if
like,
I'd seen Rocky, I would agree with you.
Yes. A guy who's, like, really kind of, you know, dragging behind, not real quick on the uptake, and he's subject to forces beyond him.
He's a simple Jack.
And then,
he's not a simple Jack.
James Gandolfini is, like, he's, like, what, the bar owner?
Yes, he's the owner of the bar.
Yeah. The progression of events is a fascinating series of ones.
It really is. And there's a couple questions that get raised about an old murder that turns out to be very important, I think.
Right,
and
right.
There's some really interesting stuff in the way this goes. I loved this movie. You sold me on the premise, and then when I started watching it, I was very engaged. Hey, and I wound up loving it by the end.
I started watching it on HBO Max. I got about an hour into it, and I stopped to make some food, sat back down. And they had taken off of HBO Max.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was like, damn it.
Nick will press play and give movies a chance, but not if you can't watch them.
Yeah. I would have finished
HBO
it.
HBO Max screwed this movie over for
it's
you.
It's true. I waited too long.
You know, you randomly, what was the movie we talked about earlier? And like, Nick's like, I bought that.
Yeah. You randomly bought movies all the time.
And the Apocalypse.
Yep.
It was, yeah.
You should randomly buy this one. But I in turn, Randy, watched it because my sister-in-law is obsessed with Tom Hardy, or right. was at the time obsessed right. with him,
yep.
and was, like, watching his entire library of movies.
Yep.
And she's like, oh, you should watch this one. This is the one. And I'm like, oh, Tom Hardy's just a guy who makes weird squeaky voices
yep.
and stuff in movies.
He's relatively restrained here as far as, like, he does a Brooklyn accent.
Right.
But, yeah.
But I was like, okay, I'm going to watch this one. And then I was like, oh, shit, it was good.
It was good.
I had to admit it in the end. yeah, it's one of my favorite, like a little small kind of crime thriller suspense thing.
Yeah.
Did you say this is the kind of crime story that Ed Brubaker would write?
Oh, yeah. This feels, Brubaker yeah. could totally write
yeah,
this
Yeah, for
story.
Sure.
Yeah. All right, I promised Hot Wings.
That's right, you did.
So let's talk about Hot Ones. This is a phenomenon that I knew roughly about. It's a YouTube series that is now on, like, Hulu. I think it's in season, like, 17.
Is it really?
There's hundreds of episodes.
I think it was making the rounds because of, what, Jenna Ortega?
Jenna Ortega did it recently. So basically, the pitch on this, this guy, it's called First We Feast, is the channel is what it was called.
Okay.
The guy whose name I'm blanking on, basically, he does 10 different hot wings, and each wing is a question. And so basically he gets people on, celebrities on, they eat hot wings in increasing heat, and they give the Scoville value,
yeah.
and then they answer questions. And
I don't want to watch people talking while they eat.
So no, they eat and then they talk.
Oh, okay.
But they have, like, you know, they have milk and water next to them. And Sean Evans, that's his name. So the interesting thing about this is, Dave, I was kind of with you. I don't want to watch people eat hot wings. Like, I don't love. I used to watch Man vs. Food, and I always liked the ones where he would do the big food challenges. But, like, the hottest hot wing challenge holds no interest for me.
Right.
I'm not a hot wing person. I would never go on this show. but for some reason, I was just like, something about it. It's even talking about it. I keep seeing clips of it.
Yep.
And so I was like, well, let's check this out. I was looking for something to background watch. And so I looked at an early episode, maybe even season one, that had Alton Brown from Good Eats and, yep. and Iron Chef America and all that. And what goes on is that basically they eat the wings. He shows the sauce.
In increasing order of spicy.
Increasing order of spicy. The first sauce is often their basic hot sauce, because Hot Ones make sauces.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one is always called the last dab, and it is like a giant superheated. It's always the hottest one. And you are encouraged to put a last dab of hot sauce, an extra dab of hot sauce in your last wing.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting is Alton Brown was, like, critiquing the sauces as they went through.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he clearly could handle the spice. He brought half and half mm-hmm. instead of milk. So, like, he was prepared.
Yeah.
And he never went into, like, that, oh, my God, and like, crying thing. He yeah. was just, like, critiquing it. And he's, like, he got, like, sauce 8. Which was the bomb, which is one they use a lot. And he's like, this is garbage. It's all heat. There's no flavor. And he's like, throws it out. He's like, this doesn't even go in the top 10.
That's funny.
But he was like, he was complimentary of both their sauces. He's like, these are actually good. They have flavor and heat. Anyway, that was interesting to me. And then the questions he asks, Sean Evans does deep dive research. Dave, you remember how when you would do interviews, mm-hmm. you would go out of your way to try and ask questions that had not been asked before?
Right, right. I always try and do enough research to, like, bypass the obvious ones.
This is like that, except this guy is a research team.
Mm-hmm.
And so the questions they ask included, like, they'll ask things about high school. They had Paul Rudd ask stuff about high school. And they will ask, like, they had Aubrey Plaza on.
Uh-huh.
And she's, of course, you know, deadpan and hilarious.
Right.
And he was asking her stuff. He asked her a thing about some role or something. She's like, how did you know that? and there's a lot. Like, the questions are really good. They're questions they haven't asked before. The personalities of the host. The Wings doing a job of basically breaking down that PR barrier.
Yeah.
Of like, you know, all these people have done millions of interviews. But as they're eating wings, they kind of have to focus on, oh, my God, my mouth is on fire.
Yeah.
And they kind of drop their facade.
Yeah.
And usually start saying the F word a lot more. and you start seeing more of them give real answers and, like, think about things, because they have to really process for to make an answer, because their brains are consumed with, hey, my mouth is on fire.
Yeah.
And it actually kind of works in a way I would not have expected.
That's funny.
When he did the interview with Terry Crews was talking about, he was talking about this. He's like, so, yeah, this kind of goes deep, because you kind of have to, you start looking for real answers. And I've become kind of obsessed with it. I've, like, been skipping around looking for people I want to see interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
The Jeff Goldblum one was a particular delight.
Okay.
Goldblum, of course, is weird and wacky
yep.
and can handle his spice.
Pretty hot there.
Yeah, I watched Alton Brown, and then I watched Gordon Ramsay.
Okay.
Which are very different food people.
Yeah.
And then I watched Paul Rudd, Aubrey Plaza. Kristen Bell was particularly interesting. Kristen Bell was interesting because her husband Dax Shepard was on the show, and he takes pride that he, like, got all the way to the end, and like they all go all the way to the end. There's a wall of shame for people who quit, which includes, like, Jim Gaffigan, I think. But most people go all the way to the end, even if they're dying.
Like, Jim Gaffigan would himself say, like, the spiciest thing he eats is mayo.
Yeah, yeah. But there's one of the recurring segments they do is the Instagram. They go on your Instagram and they do a deep dive and they find pictures and have to, like, explain the context of this Instagram picture.
Oh, wow.
And there's that. There's always questions. They, like, when he talked to Kristen Bell, he's like, well, I should definitely spend a wing to ask you about The Good Place. People are mad if we don't talk. And he did that for Terry Crews. We should definitely spend a wing to talk about the Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Yeah.
So it's 10 questions, but the answers are kind of far afield. And he doesn't... You remember Inside the Actor's Studio?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And how those are sort of deeper questions sometimes?
Yep.
There's a little bit of that to it.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's also, it's very casual. Because this guy's in, like, he's in, like, sweatpants and a t-shirt. And it's like, and they're eating hot wings. It is weirdly one of the best interview shows I've seen.
Huh,
it is, like, you talk about Marc Maron and how he does really good interviews. You know, he gets real with people and that kind of thing.
Yep.
It's kind of like that. And it's in, like, a half-hour format. They've talked to everyone from, like, you know, music stars to various celebrities, to reality show people, to chefs.
Before you mentioned that, to Shaft.
Shaft.
I was like, oh, cool. They got fictional character Shaft on there.
It's fascinating, and I'm definitely going to keep watching it bit by bit. Like, there's a ton of them. All the seasons aren't on Hulu, so you kind of jump around a bit. Oh, Nick Offerman was also really interesting.
Huh? As an aside, I didn't really see the questions, because I just saw the greatest hits of the tasting, but you mentioned the Jenna Ortega one that's been making the rounds. Apparently she has quite the tolerance for the spices, and yeah, it's like she's like in their upper reaches ones, and she's just kind of like, oh yeah, that's actually got a really good taste to it. I can kind of feel that one a little bit, but you're like, you can tell she can take it, like her, no, she's not like sweating, she doesn't have the little reddening cheeks or anything like that. Man, it is just like the biological differences between people is fascinating.
It's funny because Aubrey Plaza, I forget that she's Puerto Rican.
Uh-huh.
And she says that. She says, you know, I'm Puerto Rican. But he's like joking with her about how she's deadpan. He's like, you're going to stay deadpan throughout this whole thing? And she's like, we'll see. And then she is for about six of the wings.
Uh-huh.
And by seven, she's like, I hate you.
I'm going to have to watch this. This sounds like a lot of fun.
I think Nick Offerman made a joke. He's like, call my mom. It's surprising. It works better than you think. I did not think I was going to be like into this, but it's a shockingly good interview show.
Okay,
I would recommend it.
Okay,
I'd recommend it. And also, it does some of the hot sauce stuff.
Where does it stream or whatever?
It's on Hulu. Okay, they've got it on Hulu. But some of the hot sauces are like inventive too. I was looking at them. I'm like, there's no fucking way I would buy that. But I'm like, if I were a hot sauce person, I totally understand the appeal of this. So
I wouldn't mind being fed some chicken wings and answering questions.
So one of the other things, Alton Brown critiqued their chicken wings. He's like, what, did you overcook these? And I think that, you know, when Kristen Bell is vegan, so they did, like, they did the vegan chicken wings.
Okay.
And I think Offerman maybe did cauliflower.
Okay.
Or maybe Jeff Goldblum. Someone did, like,
I know that Offerman is quite the opposite of his character.
Yeah. So it was fascinating to watch. I definitely recommend Hot Ones.
Okay.
All right, that'll wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more, and until that time,
Yo, Yo Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com, and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.